All right. Good evening, everybody. Testing. I don't know if I'm coming through. Doesn't look like I am. Hang on a minute.
I can hear you fine, John.
Oh, yeah. Okay. I didn't see it registering on the board. So, all right, we're going to forego the music, which we usually start off with, but we've been having so much problem, we're just going to go into it. So welcome to National Liberty Alliance's weekly conference call. Today is Monday, July 3rd, 2017. We broadcast live every Monday from 9 p.m. Eastern until midnight. If you're listening over another network and you would like to ask a question or make a comment, our call-in number is 605-475-3250, and our participant code is 449389. If anyone would like to email a question, you can email your questions to questions, it's plural, questions, at nationallibertyalliance.org. Also, please support our business partners. You can find your banners, find banners on the right-hand side of our website, of which the proceeds go to support NLA's effort to save America. Also, please support NLA by donating $5 a month or more. Click on our donation tab on the top right. Okay, tonight's scripture reading is going to be Matthew chapter 12. Let's see what verses we're in. 22 through 37. So Matthew chapter 12, 22 through 37. And I don't see my voice registering. I'm still coming through there, Jen?
Yeah, you're doing fine.
Okay, thank you. Okay, let's see. This is about a house divided, cannot stand. Then was brought unto him, that's the Lord Jesus, one possessed with a devil, blind and dumb. And he healed him, insomuch that the blind and the dumb both spake and saw. And all the people were amazed and said, Is not this the son of David? But when the Pharisees heard it, they said, This fellow doeth not cast out devils but by Beelzebub, the prince of the devils. And Jesus knew their thoughts and said unto them, Every kingdom divided against itself is brought to desolation, and every city or house divided against itself shall not stand. And if Satan cast out Satan, he is divided against himself. How shall then his kingdom stand? And if I be Beelzebub, cast out devils, if I by Beelzebub cast out devils, by whom do your children cast them out? Therefore they shall be your judges. But if I cast out devils by the Spirit of God, then the kingdom of God has come unto you. Or else how can one enter into a strong man's house and spoil his goods, except he first bind the strong man, and then he will spoil his house? He that is not with me is against me. He that gathereth not with me scattereth abroad. Wherefore I say unto you, all manner of sin and blasphemy shall be forgiven unto men, but the blasphemy against the Holy Ghost shall not be forgiven unto men. But whosoever speaketh a word against the Son of Man, it shall be forgiven him. But whosoever speaketh against the Holy Ghost, it shall not be forgiven him, neither in this world, neither in the world to come. Either make the tree good and his fruits good, or else make the tree corrupt and his fruits corrupt. For the tree is known by his fruits. O generation of vipers, how can ye, being evil, speak good things? For out of the abundance of the heart the mouth speaketh. A good man out of the good treasures of his heart bringeth forth good things, and an evil man out of the evil treasures of his heart bringeth forth evil things. But I say unto you that every idle word that a man shall speak, they shall give account thereof in the day of judgment. For by thy words thou shalt be justified, and by thy words thou shalt be condemned. Okay, that was Matthew chapter 12, verses 22 through 37. I don't think Brent is with us here today. Is Brent out there? Does anyone see him?
Yeah, I can see him.
Okay, so he is with us. Okay. Yeah, I was looking early. I didn't see him early, but okay. All right. Anyway, let's see. Do we have any questions that have come in?
Yes, we have three questions this evening.
Okay.
The first question pertains to your paper 1023-303, Information to the President. And there was a comment in there about Abraham Lincoln. And you've quoted him regarding perverting the Constitution. And the questioner wants to know, does anyone have an opinion on the book The Real Lincoln by Thomas DeLorenz.
Yeah, well, you know, look, at he was an enigma. It's hard to even figure out who this guy was. You know, on the first hand of things, you know, there's all kinds of problems with this guy. But then on another side of things, I mean, look, at he rejected the bank's offer, and he was the one who realized, hey, we're a government. We can print our own money. And he did the greenbacks. I think that's what they were called. So he cast out the bankers. And, of course, he was killed for that. That is why they killed him, because he figured out, you know, the truth about money. So I think, you know, I've got the book myself on Lincoln. I started reading it. I haven't had time to get back because there was too much other good reading that I had to do. And so I haven't gotten back to it. And I don't know how valid that book is. I don't want to deny what's in that book either. So I don't know. He seems to be an enigma. I don't know if anybody else has a comment on him on that. You're welcome to that. But, I don't know, did I answer the question? What else was that on that question concerning the book?
That covered it, just as anybody have.
It was a very good comment, by the way. You know, right. A quote concerning Lincoln, and that's why we used it. But go ahead.
Okay, the second questioner says, I must agree with you. The judges are taking our cases and placing them in unknown jurisdictions. They refuse to operate in Article III court. I think as you communicate with President Trump, he needs to know that the swamp includes the judiciary. Just a suggestion, the compensation for the judges comes from Article III. Therefore, they have been paid for a long time out of a jurisdiction they refuse to recognize anymore. I think because of that, their compensation should stop.
Because of that, what should it stop?
Their compensation. In other words, if they aren't going to be in Article III court, they shouldn't be paid.
No, I think if they're not going to be in Article III court, they should be put in jail. Look at that subversion on its highest level. It's in the judiciary. It's in the judicial process. You know, if you want to take over this country, there's one way to do it. Take over the judiciary. Taking over the money is not a way of it is a form of taking over the country, of course, but you have to control the judiciary. You know, they kept that one quite secret. Because you can have control of the money, you can have control of the president, you can have control of both houses of Congress. You can have control of a whole bunch of things, but if you don't control the judiciary, then they're all going to go to jail for subversion. Unfortunately, they do control the judiciary. We're finding that out. I was kind of surprised to see that they have really captured the entire federal judiciary. I don't know if there's anybody out there that's honest. I don't want to say there isn't, but we just haven't found them yet. We'll see what's happening. And our next paper is going to make note to the president concerning the judicial swamp that needs to be drained also. So that's a good point on that one.
Okay. The next question. While in custody of the sheriff, does the defendant have to appear in court for the bail to be set?
While in custody of the sheriff, does the individual have to be in court for the bail to be set? Well, I would imagine if there's being bail set, then they're in custody of the sheriff, that they are being held. And if there's any kind of a hearing, of course, the individual, it's obvious they need to be there. After all, the case is about them. It's their unalienable right to hear what's they're being charged with. And of course, at that point, they might decide for a bail or not. But remember, bail is abused and has been abused probably for 200 years. I don't know, for as long as I've been alive anyway, it's been abused, it seems. You know, here's the bottom line. With the exception of very few, you know, with the exception of, let's say, outright murder, okay, or subversion, okay, with the exception of that, maybe there's a few other things, you know, that there would be an exception to. When a person is brought up but maybe even there too, maybe even in murder to some degree. Again, you know, it depends on how much evidence is there. But the bottom line is this. The people don't have to prove that they're not going to run in order for bail to be set and to be let go and, you know, to come back to court for the hearings and the proper judicial process. They don't have to prove that they're not going to run. It's got to be proven that they will run, or that they have a history of running, or something of that nature. Just because someone who's making the prosecutor, making the claim, thinks that, boy, if I did this, I'd run, that doesn't mean that that person there is going to run. We have to give them the opportunity. And so the law is written in such a way that if you can't prove that this person should not have bail, then they should be let loose. You know, that gentleman out in Montana, for instance, okay, he came back and forth to court every time for everything. And for the appeal, they wouldn't let him loose. You know, he should have been let loose during the appeal. Why not? He's already proven the fact that he would come, okay? He's got roots in the community, no less, his home and his wife and family. I mean, he's already proven himself. And a man doesn't have to prove himself. Someone's got to show good reason why this person would run to escape the justice. But even in jail, if someone is held for arraignment for the decision and they decided, well, this person, you know, likely committed this crime, maybe they got caught dead in the act or something, for whatever the case may be, and they felt a certain concern for the community for some reason or another, look, if they can control that person by today we got all this electronics, they can put a ring on the leg and they can control that person where they could be at certain times while they're going through trial or whatever the case may be. And most cases are not necessarily violent. Most cases are not even, aren't even violations of law to begin with, you know. But those cases that are where there's an injured party and they have to now pay restitution, and if there is a fear or some evidence that the person might try to take off and not pay that restitution, again, they can control them by knowing their location, by, again, putting some kind of an electronic ring on their leg, and they'd be permitted to go to work and do certain things and maybe be controlled by maybe not going out after a certain time of night. But if they're leaving the city or something, it could be known. So all that could be worked out. But now, what was the exact question? I think I've answered already, but what was the exact question?
No. Well, it was, does the defendant have to appear in court for the bail?
For the bail. Well, they should. And again, obviously, they'd be in jail if they're being sentenced for bail. So if someone was being detained and they were coming into a court to make a decision on bail, well, obviously, they shouldn't have. They have to be there. It's their unalienable right to be there to begin with. And if they're not there because they're in jail and they don't bring them in, that of course, is not just. So, okay, any other questions?
No, that was all the questions. The only other thing that I have is Robert had some announcements he would like to make.
Okay.
And Robert is here.
Yes, I'm here.
Good.
I just want to remind everyone that we do have calls during the week for various different committees. And I was very pleased last Wednesday night that we had a large increase in the number of people for courtroom observers. Plenty of room for more. Come on in and learn how important a courtroom observer is and what their influence can be. Love to see you there. Then on Thursday night, we have at 8 p.m. Eastern, we have natural healing. And we definitely need more people to be coming in there. I mean, with the health care as it is, we can all stand to cut our costs a little bit. And if we learn natural healing, we can take a lot of cost out of our health care. Come on in and learn. At 9 p.m. Eastern Time, right after the natural healing call, we have the courtroom observers. And we're having very good training talks going on, and people I know that are in there are learning. We'd like to see more of you come in. I want to see everyone that signed up to form a committee of safety in their counties. Come on in, learn. Learn how to do it. Learn what you can do. Learn the importance. We need all of you. Come on in. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Robert. Yeah, so anybody who's got any medical problems definitely should be there. You know, if you got arthritis, diabetes, or even a heart problem, a cholesterol problem, hardening of the arteries or anything of that nature, all of those things can be cured through vitamins and supplements. So natural healing is the way to go. So, okay, do we have anybody else that wants to speak, Jan?
Not that I'm aware of, John.
Careful, you don't want to diagnose anything. The FDA may be listening. Okay.
Well, vitamin C will cure cancer.
Oh, you can't say that. You just broke the law. Go to jail, go straight to jail.
Okay. All right, anyway, okay, if we have nobody else, then we'll move on. If you have nothing particular tonight to share, specifically, I did send out a message asking for people to give. You know, our founding fathers stood and gave pledged their lives, their fortunes, and what was the other thing? Their lives, their fortune, their honor, okay, to each other, okay? We should do no less, you know? And look at, we can all pledge $5 or more, you know, to help solve this problem. And rest assured, no one person can save America. I don't care. You know, President Trump is doing an excellent job. There are certain things he hasn't done yet. And I can understand, you know, he can't do everything all at one time. It's going to take time to do things. And I think what we're doing is a very delicate dance that he's going to be involved in dealing with these people. And, of course, he needs to become educated. And I think he has become educated quite a lot because he has read all our stuff. I understand that he has. And that's an education. So he knows what our founding fathers thought. He knows what liberty is. He should understand these things. And now, you know, learning it the first time, there's still a lot of voids, and, you know, we listen to him, and he still makes a few errors here or there. We're not all perfect. But nevertheless, he's doing a great job. And in 4 years, and even 8 years, if he could do 8 years, and I believe he can, goodness, he could turn this country right side up again and bring us right back where we need to be. But it won't take long for us to get right back to where we are today if we do not control our courts. You cannot have liberty without justice, a just court. You just can't have it. A nation cannot be just without a just court. And therefore, you know, our dealings with other nations will not be just. But if we have justice in our courts, then our political process would be just, believe it or not, it would be. And of course, our dealings with other countries would be just. I wouldn't be going out there creating all this havoc, which is creating all these wars from one country against another, and so on. So anyway, look it. Only the people can save America and keep it. That's it. We have to have just courts. So anybody that believes that should be given $5 a month or more. You also should be given at least an hour a week or more. Okay, joining a committee, getting involved with, courtroom observers, getting around. We got so many things going on and so many different committees. You can make your choice, or you can create your own committee, you know. Just have to bring it up to the leadership, and if they agree that this is appropriate for what we're doing, then, of course, we'll, work on a committee, whatever it is that people might want to do. But, again, it has to be appropriate. Okay. Let's see. All right, I guess I don't have anything else, and there's no... Yeah, go right ahead.
I just want to say something. I want to put something in perspective for people when it comes to Donald Trump and the new administration and the tasks that they're up against, and which many people may not be aware, and I don't even know that Donald Trump was aware of it until he came into office, that there is a whole government inside of the government. It's a dark government. It's an underground government. The money that's been missing, like the $2 trillion from the Pentagon that Donald Rumsfeld revealed back in 9/11, of course, all the records got blown up, if you can believe that. We've now figured out that it's closer to $5 trillion. They've been building – anything important is underground. They don't tell presidents anything. The only people they tell, they don't even tell admirals. If they don't think that you're going to be loyal and down with their program, they won't tell you about it. So therefore, you have people in very high places that have no idea that there's this massive amount of income and this government inside of the government that's in, it's here, it's in the UK, it's all over the world. They sit up at this table. The CFR is one of them, and Hillary's a member of the CFR, and that's one reason they can't get rid of her. Now, a couple weeks ago, they showed a news article with Donald Trump on a chemtrail plane with all the tanks and stuff, and he said, we're going to get rid of this, we're going to defund it. But in the article, they said it could take time to get rid of this and defund it. And the reason that it could take time, and I don't know if the article said this, but what they were inferring is they don't have controls of the funds. It's absolutely illegal, unlawful, and unconstitutional, but they're very powerful because they're very rich, and they kill people. And so in order for him to get anything done, he has to have a team of people that are going to go after this dark government that is very well-funded, and they have technology that they've had hidden. Look at any technology that you see today. It's all 1930.
Just think what we could do if we had just courts, Dan.
Well,
we'd shut it down in one day.
They have technology that we could be burning water. We have free energy, but the petrol dollar does not want to let it come out. One admiral who was made aware of this, he said, look, nobody wants to do this. It's too big. He says, my thing is to keep the country running with the petrol dollar that we're on now, and I want to retire and go fishing on my ranch in Montana. That's my interest. You think I'm going to attack this thing? What do you think, I'm crazy? See, it's such a big problem. That's what we're up against, and they're evil. And the problem is, if they've gotten so arrogant and so evil that people are starting to come out against them because they're doing stuff that is absolutely beyond your imagination. I mean, there are stories of them, you know, torturing children and taking their blood for transfusions because it's an elixir on aging or something. I mean, these guys, there's nothing that they won't, no place they won't go and nothing they won't do. So it's a very evil system, but you can't just go in there and think that you're going to disassemble it, because it's much harder than that. They have more money than all the GDPs of all of Europe and all of Eastern Europe and Western Europe. They got more money than all of their GDPs, which is a lot of money. So they're going to be hard to stop. And what's going to happen is they're going to have to chink at them piece by piece. And I don't know if anybody saw the interview with Greenspan the day that the Congress called him out. And he said, we don't listen to anybody. Nobody can tell us what to do. And as long as the government's not trying to tell people to not do what we tell them to do, then we don't have any, we don't care about what relationship we have with the president or Congress or anybody else. So he stood there and said that he was above everything in this government and every government on the world, that nobody can tell them what to do. And nobody said anything. And you know the day that happened, you know what was going on that day that all the fake news media was screaming about and that all the people were paying attention to? That's the day Obama released his fake birth certificate. So this is how organized they are. They wait for that thing to come, and then they say, okay, Obama, release that certificate. So now that's what was in the news, and there was only a little blurb in there, and Greenspan's words fell on deaf ears. We should have got together, and we should have immediately demanded the end of the Fed. We should have slapped him, put him in cuffs, and say, look it, you tell us you're not going to listen to us? Well, here, sit in this cell for a while and see how you like that. That's what should have happened. So it's not going to be easy, but the knowledge is out there now, and it's not going to go away. So that's the good
thing. If we had real grand juries, you know, and not puppet grand juries, we could have closed down the Fed, and we could have put all those people in jail. Of course,
actually,
we can't do it until we get control of the courts.
I
would like to add a little to that, what
mm-hmm.
Gerard said.
Yeah.
It's, 4 years before Trump came out to run for president, he realized that we had this big underground, this deep state, and he realized that he was going to have his own army just as big. And so he began 4 years before he started running to put his own army together. And what they are is all the big attorney firms around the world. And so I have to believe that they're all, you know, working toward taking the deep state apart. I keep expecting that at some point we're going to see something happen.
And you know, the deep state is basically all these big corporations like Monsanto that's poisoning us, that gets the Congress to pass the Monsanto Protection Act as they're giving us cancer and killing us. So
that's their deep state also, the senators.
Absolutely. So, you know, now there's something like 23 countries that have outlawed GMOs, America not being one of them. So you're not going to stop that. The word is out. These guys are in trouble, and they know it. So I keep waiting to see what's going to happen, that first domino to fall that's going to start the whole ball running downhill, you know. Once they see one of their members gone, then all the protection is gone. They'll run like rats from a sinking ship. That's what I think. Right now, we haven't had any one of them go to jail. The first one that goes to jail, they'll all start ratting on each other. That's when you watch what happens. I mean, they're doing it now behind the scenes, but you got to get somebody big like Greenspan or Hillary Clinton. Once they go, the lower ones know that they got no protection at that point. So that's what
okay.
I got.
Thanks. Okay, let's move on. We're going to move over to Brent. Brent Winters is the author of Excellence in Common Law. His website is commonlawyer.com. Brent, you got the mic.
Thanks. Thank you, John. Back when I was a child, Longfellow exhorted us to listen. He said, "Listen, my children, and you shall hear of the midnight ride of Paul Revere on the 18th of April in 75. Hardly a man is now alive who remembers that famous day and year. He said to his friend, "If the British march by land or sea from the town tonight, hang a lantern aloft in the belfry arch of the old North Church tower as a signal light. One if by land, and two if by sea, and I on the opposite shore will be ready to ride and spread the alarm through every Middlesex village and farm for the country folk to be up and to arm." Then he said good night, and with muffled oar silently rode to the Charlestown shore. Just as the moon rose over the bay with a swinging wide at her moorings lay the Somerset, British man of war, a phantom ship, with each mast and spar across the moon like a prison bar. And a huge black hulk that was magnified by its own reflection in the tide. Meanwhile, his friend through alley and street wanders and watches with eager ears till the silence around him he hears the muster of men at the barrack door, the sound of arms and the tramp of feet and the measured tread of the grenadiers marching down to their boats on the shore. Then he climbed the tower of the old North Church by the wooden stairs with stealthy tread to the belfry chamber overhead and startled the pigeons from their perch on the somber rafters that round him made masses and moving shapes of shade. By the trembling ladder, steep and tall, to the highest window in the wall, where he paused to listen and look down a moment on the roofs of the town and the moonlight flowing over all. Meanwhile, impatient to mount and ride, booted and spurred with a heavy stride on the opposite shore walked Paul Revere. Now he patted his horse's side. Now he gazed at the landscape far and near, and turned and tightened his saddle girth. But mostly he watched with eager search the belfry tower of the old North Church, as it rose above the graves on the hill, lonely and spectral and somber and still. And lo, as he looks in the belfry height, a glimmer, and then a gleam of light. He springs to the saddle, the bridle he turns, but lingers and gazes till full in his sight a second lamp in the belfry burns. A hurry of hoofs in a village street, a shape in the moonlight, a bulk in the dark, and beneath from the pebbles and passing a spark, struck out by a steed flying fearless and fleet. That was all, and yet, through the gloom and the light, the fate of a nation was riding that night. And the spark struck out by that steed in his flight kindled the land into flame with its heat. He has left the village and mounted the steep, and beneath him tranquil and broad and deep is the mystic meeting of the ocean tides. And under the alders that skirt its edge, now soft on the sand, now loud on the ledge, is heard the tramp of his steed as he rides. It was 12 by the village clock when he crossed the bridge into Medford town. He heard the crowing of the cock and the barking of the farmer's dog, and felt the damp of the river fog that rises after the sun goes down. It was 1 by the village clock when he galloped into Lexington. He saw the gilded weathercock swim in the moonlight as he passed, and the meeting house windows, black and bare, gaze at him with a spectral glare, as if they already stood aghast at the bloody work they would look upon. It was 2 by the village clock when he came to the bridge in Concord town. He heard the bleating of the flock and the twitter of the birds among the trees, and felt the breath of the morning breeze blowing o'er the meadow brown. And 1 was safe and asleep in bed, who at that bridge would be the first to fall, who that day would be lying dead, pierced by a British musket ball. You know the rest. In the books you have read how the British regulars fired and fled, how the farmers gave them ball for ball from behind each fence and farmyard wall, chasing the redcoats down the lane, then crossing the fields to emerge again under the trees at the turn of the road, and pausing only to fire and reload. So through the night rode Paul Revere, and so through the night went his cry of alarm to every Middlesex village and farm, a cry of defiance and not of fear, a voice in the darkness, a knock at the door, and a word that shall echo forevermore. For borne on the night wind of the past, through all of our history, to the last, in the hour of darkness and peril and need, the people will waken and listen to hear the hurrying hoofbeats of that steed and the midnight message of Paul Revere. Beautiful poem, hardly mentioned in our day, but was popular for, well, even when I was growing up, we had to read, we didn't have to read it, we liked to read it in school. But I dare say it's not read in school at all. But when people find themselves in a crisis, all the history of Adam's race teaches us that they instinctively, by the laws of nature's God, or I should say the laws of nature more particularly, he built it into our system. We instinctively turn our eyes toward our origins and look there for a sign. Is it any wonder, as men and women grow older, and I've watched quite a few grow older, and now I'm starting the process myself, I suppose. I'm certainly not getting any younger. But as they grow older, I notice that they would remember the most uncannily particular details about the past and their origins and their growing up, and their mind would go back pretty often. I've had some of them tell me even that they live on memories because they're approaching that time when life as they know it will be no more. It's a bit of a crisis. And instinctively, they turn their eyes back and look at their origins, and they reevaluate. I think all of us would do this. Be well if we did it when we were young. We reevaluate from whence we have come, because if we do not know from whence we have come, we do not know which way we're tending. And if we don't know which way we're tending, we don't know where we're going. But that's why it's important that we have an anchor, and that history is important. There's one thing about the law of the evil empire, the law of the city, that is its main feature, and it is this, that you get rid of the past. You don't talk about it anymore, because people that are anchored in the past, as we in our common law country are, even our common law is anchored in the past. It always looks backwards before it looks forward. It looks back and say, well, what it says, well, what have the courts done in cases like this that were on similar facts? What have the courts done? It is the pole star of our common law tradition. That's why God gives us the laws of nature's God, as Blackstone tells us, the Bible, so that we can look in the past and see what happened to people that did do what the true lawgiver said to do, and we can see what happened to those that did not. And it is very unbiased, the way the Bible presents it. It doesn't, when those history books, it doesn't say this fellow was right and that fellow was wrong all the time. It says it sometimes, but not always. It just tells you what happened, and you can make up your own mind. That's true throughout the Bible, by the way. Sometimes it will say, well, that was right and that was wrong, but in the mass of the cases of history, and as Paul the Apostle says, these things are written. Now, wait a minute, it might not have been Paul, but it's in the New Testament. He said, these things were written for your learning. Well, Paul didn't say something equivalent to that. I don't know if he's one that said those exact words. He said that all of it was written for doctrine, for reproof, for correction, for instruction. So it does us good to have the 4th of July. It is instinctive to want to look back and say, who are we? And let's think about this. God himself, you're probably thinking this as I'm talking, oh yeah, God himself says, he said to his people, I want you to remember what I did for you way back there in the evil empire in the iron dungeons and furnaces of Egypt. And I want you to, every year, hold what I call Passover, when I passed over you. And I didn't, the angel of death passed over you. That's me, by the way. I'm acting as the angel of the death, of death here. I'm the one that caused this to happen. I passed over you because you struck the transom and the sidepost of your door with the blood of the lamb, and you consumed the lamb, and I killed only the firstborn of those of the evil empire, the Egyptians, animal and man, by the way. Even in the prisons, even in the palaces, he killed all the firstborn of everything in Egypt except the Israelites that had gotten themselves, they put the sign of the blood, of the coming blood of the Messiah, so that they wouldn't be killed. He said, remember that. Don't forget it. And even yet today, we still celebrate. And it's a celebration. It's the table, the Lord's table, we call it. And we don't redo it. It's done. But we celebrate that. Jesus Christ took the Passover, and he held the Lord's Supper there in the upper room. And it was a symbolic act. And we today have taken it, that whole thing that happened in Egypt, as our understanding and our Christian world in Christendom, our understanding that God has saved us, and we need to be reminded of it. Some churches do it every Sunday. Some do it every quarter. Some do it once a year. That's the way we did it when I was growing up. I kind of like that idea because that's the way the Passover is done, once a year. But all of these things are important, and the 4th of July is important. The Declaration of 76 is important, and we should be thankful that somebody took time to say that they took time to establish it, that we take time off and not forget why we're doing what we're doing and why we're, I'm going to pull that out here, why we're celebrating the 4th of July. Well, to the standard here, the Declaration of 76, I want to mention, move forward in it just a little bit, as we have time to here. I think we left off about, it was in paragraph 2. I'd read the part of paragraph 2 that said, But when a long train of abuses and usurpations pursuing invariably the same object evinces a design to reduce them, these colonies, what he's talking about, under absolute despotism, it is their right, it is their duty to throw off such government and to provide new guards for their future security. I try to point out that the Declaration of 76 is not a call to arms. There's no place in it where you can find that. But you can extrapolate some of these words here and think that's what it amounts to. Now, there does come a point when enough's enough. A while ago, the deep state was mentioned, the deep state. And as far as that came up recently, the deep state, people started talking about it not too long ago. And I got looking into it, and I discovered that the deep state was first mentioned. King James the First of King James Bible fame mentioned the deep state, and he said to one of his critics, no, it wasn't him, it was one of his ministers, one of his close associates said that nobody has any business knowing what really goes on in the deep state. That's our business. Well, that was divine right of kings, civil law kind of doctrine. King James held that position, and he thought he was God, same as God on earth, and had authority in his own realm, and he answered to no man, and nobody was supposed to question him, and there were a lot of people who believed that. He did, but we don't believe that, and as a matter of fact, his point of view was put to rest, and especially a little later on during that same century, the 17th century, people flocked to America, Puritans, or Puritan-minded people especially, but many of them different shades of Puritanism. And fundamental to Puritanism, they finally got to control the Congress, and they went to war, the Puritans did, against the crown. But the fundamental, and that's why people came here, George Washington's grandfather came to America because he joined the crown in that struggle in England, and he came here to keep from getting his head chopped off. And a lot of people came for that reason, and a lot of Puritans came because they got tired of the fight, and they didn't want their heads chopped off inadvertently either. And it was odd that here in America, the people that were for the crown and that struggle back in the 1640s, families of those people, such as George Washington, and those people that were against the crown and their families fought on the other side of that revolution, and won, by the way, the Puritans, namely, and the Presbyterians. In America, they joined forces. Virginia and New England joined forces to fight the British, but they broke apart again later, as we well know, and had another war. But all of these things to understand our history is to understand from whence we came and whence we're tending. Now, I know which direction I'm tending, and I know the folks on this conference call, I've gotten a feel for which direction their heads are tending. And it seems to me they're right-headed. You folks, the ones I've met and talked to, you want to promote true law. You want to say that the law is important, and the true law is important, and the lawgiver in America, as a practical matter, here on earth, among men, government has been delegated to it, lawgiver, from whose decision there is no realistic appeal. That's what a lawgiver is, called a god in the Bible and throughout the ancient world, and yet today a god is someone or something, some institution, from whose decision in individual cases there is no meaningful appeal. And the courts are key in America, and the jury even becomes more key, you see, among men now. That's important, and that's where it doesn't make any difference what else you do. If the courts are wrong-headed and they're hijacked, when individual cases come up, people will not get justice, and justice only occurs on an individual level. Well, it says here that when they're reduced under absolute despotism, it is their right, it is their duty, and a right is a duty. That's why he says it that way. A right is an old Germanic Anglo-Saxon word. It means duty. It means jurisdiction also. Jurisdiction means duty, obviously. To throw off such government and provide new guards for their future security. We're dealing with the deep state. Now, these folks back in the colonies, when they went to war against the British crown, and it's called the American Revolution, but it was in no sense a revolution. It wasn't a vengeance for the past. That's not what folk were interested in doing. They were interested in doing what it says here. They were interested in the future, to provide new guards, new safeguards for their future security. And new safeguards for their future security. And that's what they ended up doing. But ultimately what happened was what they wanted was their common law government and their common law rights, which are their duties. The volk right, as the Anglo-Saxons called it. The volk, the people, the folk right, duty. It is the folk's duty, the volk right. That's what they wanted back, and they said so, just like that. They told Parliament that on several occasions. And they wanted to reestablish that, and they did, and they put in new guards, you see, with their common law that England had never come to put in place. But England had done a lot. They, habeas corpus, we've talked about that. That was a guard for protection against false imprisonment, you see. And that's just one great example, but there were other things they did, too. And they went to a bloody, terrible war over it, the Puritans against the crown. And they tried to settle the issue. Well, what ended up happening was they ended up making Parliament sovereign. So Parliament's still sovereign, yet, as a matter of theory anyway, in England. They fudged that quite a bit. But we tried that in America. We tried to make the state legislatures sovereign. We thought that was a good idea. By the way, that's called pure republicanism. Republicanism. Very dangerous. Matter of fact, it's more tyrannical than democracy. And people said this in the past too, so I'm quoting others. If there's anything worse than a dictator, it's a combination of men that combine to form a single will as a dictator because they are utterly uncontrollable. A dictator, if you get your hands on him, you can get rid of him, as Ben Franklin said. But a parliament or a Congress, very dangerous if we come to think that they're sovereign. Well, the states tried that right after our American separation from Britain, and some of them found out they didn't want that at all. They built their government on the model of what had happened after the English Revolution. So what we ended up doing here was what the common law had always required and what had occurred in Anglo-Saxon England many centuries before Magna Carta, before the Norman invasion of the year 1066, was the co-equal powers of government. In other words, the Congress, if we apply it here in America, and our Constitution does this, by the way, makes the branches of government co-equal. Parliament has no trumping power over Donald Trump, and Donald Trump has no trumping power ultimately over Congress and the courts have no trumping power over Donald Trump and the Congress. The branches are co-equal. And it's good, though, that we have a check on any one of the branches running amok, and that is politics. DJ Trump has the Army, the Navy, the Air Force, the Marines, the CIA, the FBI, the NAS, the ATF, and on, ad infinitum, ad nauseum, alphabet soup bureaucracies. He's the guy that's got aircraft carriers at his disposal. He could hammer down, if he went out of control, a whole lot of people, including probably Congress and the courts. But he, on the other hand, he knows he can't get away with that. And I'm not saying that he wants to do that, but I'm pointing out that there is that, as John Fortescue said, that political element of common law government. The branches are co-equal, but it is the people of the United States, the militia of the United States, the juries of the United States, that's the people, that's the militia, that hold it all in check. And without us, having power, as we can exert it, and if we aren't exerting it to its full extent at every point, as the law allows, then we're not doing our job and we'll be run over. Congress would be run over if it didn't overexert itself. The president would be run over. The executive branch, but he didn't overexert himself. The courts would be reduced to a nullity if they didn't exert themselves to the full extent of the jurisdiction, the power that is lawfully given to them. And the key and the genius of our common law tradition, and that's what they were fighting for back there in 1776, they said it just that way. The right to bear arms is part of that too, by the way. The key to all of it is the separation and the disbursement of power throughout the people of our country. The states, there's another disbursement. Each one of the states is sovereign. And then there are within the branch, the legislative branch of government, the legislative branch is split into two branches. In England, they call it the two branches of the legislature. Well, we don't call it that here, but that's what it is, another splitting of power. Now, not every state has two branches of the state legislature, but Most of them do, but still there's co-equal powers. Well, we're very fortunate, of course, to live in such a country, and I'm glad to hear DJ Trump make some positive comments about the 4th of July, and it's refreshing to me to see the fireworks. But it's important to all of us that we not end up doing what the ancient Israelites did and celebrated all of the things that God said to celebrate and didn't have a clue, not a clue, why they were doing it. But they just loved to get together and have fun. And we do see a lot of that. And it is important to have fun, but there must be a time of solemnity where we stop and say, thank you, Lord, God of heaven, maker of heaven and earth, and all that in them is, because we have nothing we have not received from above. Well, thanks, John, and happy 4th of July to everybody.
Okay. Thank you, Brent. Appreciate that. Okay, we're going to open up the Q&A right now. Anybody wants to get in the Q&A, star 6 to get into the Q&A. Any questions for us, Brent? Bring them up. Okay, let's take our first caller. It's 989 number. That's the area code, 989. Maybe you can give us your first name and your state. Go right ahead.
Greta from Michigan.
How you doing, Greta?
Real good. I'm going to take you off from speaker, so I just a moment here. Can you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead. Try it again. Go ahead. We can hear you.
I was just trying to take you off from speaker.
All right.
There. I have you off from speaker. Can you hear me better now?
Yep. Appreciate that. Go right ahead.
Bless you. Thank you for letting me have a moment of time. I have a case with Genesee County court system, probate. I spent 4.5 months incarcerated. The judge said civil contempt of court, indefinite incarceration. And there has been so much corruption that it would make the water corruption that is known now nationally, but on the cover of Time magazine, look like Mickey Mouse. That whole town is corrupt, folks. And I have the paperwork to back up everything I say. I don't expect anybody to take my word for anything. I've been blessed in the sense that I have all the documentation. And you want to talk about being completely rogue. This judge is rogue, folks. She allowed them to accuse me of a heinous crime with zero substantiating evidence, zero. And I'm still licensed to carry a weapon, which I have been licensed since 2010, and I'm presently still licensed. Because I'm not a criminal. I'm not the criminal. She's the criminal. And my case was over $700,000. That was unlawfully taken from me. I've been stripped of all of my belongings 3 times now, and they're still attacking me. Supposedly there's a bench warrant out against me, but golly, the last time I was fingerprinted, because I work in the medical field, it shows nothing. And I just had an attorney's law firm, not my attorney, I don't have one, look into it for over 1.75 hours to try to find where this supposed bench warrant was, but I couldn't find it. But according to the Owosso Police Department, which is where I live in Michigan, they said there is one. That's concerning, because if anybody thinks I want to go back to jail again, think again, I don't. Civil contempt of court, indefinite incarceration. I don't know if anybody's ever heard of that. But that's,
well, first of all, that court doesn't have the power to fine or incarcerate. Only a court of record can do that, you know, in a civil court, you know, where they, I mean, just unheard of what you're talking about as far as indefinite.
I have all the proof.
I'm not denying it because these people are out of control. If you want,
you should write
an affidavit
I did.
And tell your story, okay, and then get it to us, okay, and then we'll get it into the case.
Bless you. I can't thank you enough. I could just cry. I'm so thankful that people like yourselves exist. You give me hope. I've bloodied my knees talking to God over this because he knows I'm not guilty. They are. And thank you, Jesus. I have all the documentation. So nobody has to beat the bushes to find the proof. I have it. But so far, nobody has challenged that court system. She's rogue. Nobody stops her, and she does what she wants. The last attorney I had, she arrested him in the middle of the courtroom for trying to defend me, and then she later fined him $400,000. There's a paper
trail. Remember when you write your affidavit, which you said you already have, but make sure that you add the name of the court, the name of the judge, or any other individual that has violated your rights, violated you as an individual. Get that into the affidavit because it is our intention that at some point in time, the only thing necessary for a prima facie case is an affidavit, period, a sworn statement. That's all that's necessary. And so when you bring that in, you bring in the basic, information, and you name the individuals that have injured you, and we'll get into the case. At some point in time, all of these affidavits need to be responded to by prosecutors. And then, of course, more information will be gathered, and we can do call a grand jury and do potential indictments and so on. Now, of course, it's going to take some time. Maybe we don't know how long. It could take months, it could take years, but we're at that point.
Sir, what frightens me is that I could get picked up at any time and put back into that hellish jail of Genesee County. That's the armpit of Michigan.
I understand that, yeah.
I'm really afraid of that.
Well, hopefully by putting your affidavit into this court concerning that whole issue, you can then refer back to that to let them know that you've already reported this to the grand jury and it's in a federal case because of the uncontrollable judiciary. I presume is, you said probate court, so that's probably a state court, right?
Yeah, she's been in trouble before. She's had her cases overturned by all the judges.
Yeah, they're all in trouble.
Yeah, but you can't accuse somebody of stabbing somebody with zero evidence just to taint the jury on an undue influence.
Well, look, make sure that you have somebody, a friend or somebody, that can contact us should you be arrested again, and give us the information on when you're going to be arraigned or whatever information concerning a court case, and you get it to our courtroom observers. And our courtroom observers will put the word out, and you get a couple of people, maybe a whole bunch of people. Sometimes we get a couple of people. Even just one or two people often can help. But if we can get more in the courtroom, of course, that's even better.
Right. Is that an exorbitant amount of time, 4.5 months, to be put in jail for civil contempt of court?
Oh, I would think so. Brent, what do you think about that? Contempt of court, and what was the contempt of court? Would you just want to bring up some truth
civil,
that they didn't say here?
Civil contempt of court.
Well, how did you get out? I'm really curious. How did you get out after 4 months?
They said that there was overcrowding, and they kicked me out. I went in August the 13th of 2013. And they kicked me out on the 19th of October and told me I had to come back.
You're saying that the judge didn't have your order released.
Overcrowding.
I see. I never heard of a... Normally, contempt is 6 months, and if you don't comply in 6 months, you're released. Because the purpose of civil contempt, as you were talking about, is not punishment. The purpose of civil contempt is to get compliance. And if you're tough enough and you believe you're right, the court just tests your mettle. That's all it amounts to. If you remember Susan McDougal, that in the Whitewater affair, she wouldn't talk. She took the Fifth and they
threw
her in.
Sir, they had me in with two heinous criminals. One chopped her granddaughter into 11 pieces. That was my cellmate. Well, it's Janish. And then my other cellmate shot her husband twice. They're both in prison. Those were my cellmates.
Yeah, prisons are not pretty places. But I'm surprised you're fortunate she got out. But no, I've heard of a case. There's a famous case that about 15 years old now. I remember the words media were in. It was in the Ninth Circuit, I believe, and it was federal court. And the fellow had money in the Cook Islands, and the judge told him to get it. And he had established the trust and put a provision in the trust that if there was any time a threat to the trust assets, that automatically, according to the law of the Cook Islands, the trustee there, who was a Cook Islander, professional trustee, he was to not obey the order of any court, including United States federal courts. Well, he was in a sovereign country. He could do that. Well, he got upset. He got scared because of the power of the United States courts, and he submitted his case to the courts of the Cook Islands then for instructions, because if you do that, you can't hit. If you do what the court says and just submit the case to them, put an interpleader in, so to speak, then you're out of the soup. And he did that. But the judge back in the United States said this. He said, you're the one that caused this trigger to happen. You're the problem. So what he did was he jailed him for contempt, and he said, you're jailed for indefinitely, but not forever. Indefinitely, but not forever. Those words have never been used before until the last couple of decades. He eventually got out. I forget how long he stayed. But 6 months is the norm. 18 months is the absolute outside that anybody's ever heard of in America at common law. Doesn't mean it's easy, but if you really are convicted about keeping your mouth shut, for example, not talking or not doing, you think that the judge...
I had nothing to hide, Brett.
Oh, I believe you, but if you really believe what you're right, then that's what that's all about. I'd be curious to know, too, ma'am, what was the contempt? Did you say something the judge didn't like, or what happened?
No, the judge accused me of having money in which I did not possess. She never allowed me to speak to show where the money went. The money that I possessed, I was legal to have. My husband that passed away, his niece sued me. She works in a nearby courthouse. The first time she sued me, she said that our marriage was not legal. And my attorney brought in documentation that, in fact, it was, case was closed, and the motion was denied. The second time she sued me, she said, well, maybe the marriage was legal, but my husband didn't have a clue what he was doing. And my attorney brought in 8 validated, documented statements, affidavits from 8 different professional entities, Morgan Stanley, Raymond James, Wells Fargo, Citizens Bank, 2 medical doctors, et cetera. And so the judge denied her case and closed the case. And so then the third time she sued me, she come back with a different attorney. This time the attorney seemed to blow kisses across the courtroom to the judge. They were very familiar with one another, and nothing was legal thereafter. Only this time it wasn't that my marriage wasn't legal or my husband didn't know what he was doing, because it was proven beyond a doubt that in fact was not the case. This time they accused me of undue influence. I forced my husband into marrying me. And then they had jury trial. Sir?
Did you have a gun to his head, did they say, or how did they say
you
did
no,
that?
No, I didn't. And it was absolutely a farce.
Yeah,
but listen, moments before the jury was to go deliberate whether I used undue influence or not, they held up a 3-foot by 3-foot poster of an anatomical figure of a body, and they passed it for each juror to hold in horror. You could see the look of horror on their face. And they suggested I had stabbed my husband 3 times in the shoulder and grotesquely bruised his groin. And I thought, are you kidding me? And I'm sitting on the witness stand, and I'm thinking to myself, how come my attorney's not up on his feet defending me, objecting? I'm trying to defend myself from the witness stand. The judge looks at me, points her finger at me, and tells me to shut up, that I'll only answer the questions posed.
Right, but the bottom line, the contempt was that they wanted information out of you, certain information, you wouldn't give it. Is that what it was?
No. They tried to suggest I had money hidden somewhere, but they would not let me show them where I had bought things, and I was legal to purchase these things. I didn't criminally obtain money.
Oh, I see.
My name was legally on these items. And I tried to show them, well, listen, that the plaintiff already has this, the plaintiff already has that. I've submitted everything I've got. What do you guys want? And now you say, and listen, they held court multiple times with nobody present but them.
Uh-huh.
They turned around and held court from $200. They said, I owed them $200,000. They'd already taken over $700. And they said that I owed them that, but my attorney wasn't present. I was in jail, so I wasn't present. I see the documentation, and they upped it from $200,000 to $407,000. And they wrote
uh-huh.
on the testimony card, no objection.
Uh-huh.
Well, of course there's no objection. There's nobody in court to object.
Yeah. Hello? I know it's bad.
And here's the thing, real quick. I just got to say this. Listen, his death certificate showed nothing of stab wounds. He passed away in the hospital. Certainly there would be documentation if there were stab wounds, and they'd have to call the police. It was for one purpose, and that was to taint the jury against me. And I might admit it worked quite well.
Mm-hmm.
But
you're out now.
The
question now is, what are you going to do? What are you going to do next? That's what you got to think about.
What
happened happened, and you got to think about what you're going to do next.
Bless you.
Yeah.
And I'm concerned about it. And listen, I'm concerned. I'm 56 years old. I'm on the lam. I have nothing. When I was 50, I walked out of the courtroom at 53, and I had absolutely nothing. I didn't even have a toothbrush. And it wasn't like I was a slouch. I was a director of marketing for Genesee County. I worked over a year after we were married. I wasn't just a gold digger that threw my hands in the air and said, gee, I'm rich, I don't have to. I continued to work. So the whole thing is a rogue situation that I just need somebody with legal knowledge to please buddy up with me and help me. Because if I don't have help, I'm completely at the mercy of this.
Well, I can tell you that I believe that the probate courts are the worst courts because they're always dealing with money, and then they try to set up fiduciary authority and give control to some lawyer, and they seal up everything, and then they just spend all your money, and it's all corrupt. And if someone is connected some way into the court system. And know some judges and stuff, I could see the corruption work there too, because these people, there's no end to their corruption, what they've done. They have no feeling or concern of, it seems, of guilt of anything they do. They think that that they have the control and they can do what they want with it.
Dog. It's like being waterboarded and again and again and again. And I need somebody to make it stop. Make it stop. Make them be known for what they have done to me. I have all the documentation. As a matter of fact, as God would have it, and it's interesting, I've never called not one of the jurors, but I have all their names and their addresses and telephone numbers. Imagine that. Do you think one of them might remember them accusing me of stabbing my husband moments before they deliberated my case of undue influence? I think one of them could remember out of the 12.
Right. Well, look, the best we can do for you is, again, get your affidavit in complete details, and we'll get it into the court. And at some point in time, this injustice must be dealt with. And we'll just take
Thank
it from
you.
There.
Thank
okay.
You.
We appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Let's take our next caller. Michael, it looks like, from New York.
Hello.
Yep. Go right ahead, Mike.
Hey, thank you very much. The only question I have is I lost my debit card. I got a new one, and I'm trying to donate on the site. And for some reason or other, it won't let me add my card in there, the numbers on my card. Is there a problem with the site tonight, or is it just me?
Yeah, not that I'm aware of. I don't know. Is Carl on the phone? Carl, are you on the call here? Yeah, I don't know. Try again tomorrow. See what happens. I don't know why it didn't recognize and deal with your card. And if not, you can get a hold of Jan. Maybe, what's tomorrow? Tomorrow's the 4th of July. It's Tuesday, so Wednesday. Maybe you can get a hold of Jan on Wednesday if you can't do anything. And then Jan will try to get a hold of Paul and call see what Carl can do from our side, because that is something that's controlled, I believe, on our end. But I'm not sure because we do have a credit card service. So you're good.
The trouble with debit cards is every bank has their own policies. I've had trouble with mine. If I spend outside of my normal pattern, or if I spend overseas, or a bunch
of
other...
Yeah, you got to call them and they could push
they
it through, right?
They lock the card up right away. Oh, well, your algorithm changed. You know, they do this with debit cards. They make it hard. And so you need to check also with your bank. Like, maybe they don't, you know, there's something there that's kicking the security on it. But they have a lot of...
It is a debit credit card, right? Like a MasterCard or a Visa or something like that, right?
Yes, it's a MasterCard. It worked last time, but I lost my card, and I had to get a new one. And I want to make sure that my donation goes in each month.
Yeah, it should go through. Again, try it, tomorrow or the day after tomorrow and see if it goes through. You know, and try calling your bank to see if there's a problem on that end. And then if they say that's not a problem, it should have gone through, then you get a hold of Jan, and Jan will get a hold of Carl, and we'll see what we could do on our end. If I have to, we have a service. You know, first of all, it comes through the site itself, and then from there it goes into the credit card service that we use, which actually does all the transactions and charges us for those transactions. They could be rejecting it too on that end. I would have to probably deal with it on that end. But first, we got to find out if it's being rejected first, either by your bank and or by somewhere in our electronic part of our process.
Right. Okay, might be at my end too. I'll try it again tomorrow and see what happens, and I'll keep trying it until I get it. Don't worry, it'll get in there one way or the other.
All right, thanks, Mike. Appreciate it.
Yes, thank you very much. I yield, guys. God bless.
Okay.
Thank you.
Good day. Okay, let us take Cynthia from Arizona. Go right ahead, Cynthia.
I called a couple of days ago, probably a couple of sessions ago. Can you hear me?
Go ahead. We can hear you.
I called a couple of sessions ago, a couple of months ago, about my administrative process, the lack of judicial due process. I sent in. I haven't heard anything from them. But, you know, I listen all the time. And I always just feel like I was reading the Constitution last night, and I just feel like, you know, the people have to wake up. I mean, we can sit here and moan and groan and complain all day long, but we have to get up and do things. You know, like they don't even teach history. They don't even teach history and civics in school anymore. And I was getting ready to buy new, like, mortgages. Like, people don't even realize it. Banks don't even really have they're not even supposed to have the power that they have. I mean, like, the people are the ones who have the signatures. And I was reading something about how these executive orders go through, and the president doesn't have the power to put these executive orders through, and Congress is asleep, and the people are complaining. So I mean, like, you know, how do we? I try to do as much as I can, but it's like I feel like I live in this fishbowl because everyone thinks I'm a nut. So I really want to be able to do something to be able to make a difference. Right now, I think I'm gonna start buying houses and waking up people with, you know, because like with these non-judicial foreclosures.
You're dealing with a non-judicial foreclosure problem though right now,
no,
right?
No, I'm not doing it. I don't know. I'm going to start to buy houses.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to start buying houses because I'm kind of waiting on this administrative process, this thing that I sent in. I haven't heard anything from them. I sent in, I remember I told you about the situation with the Inspector General. So they did this, they did the non-judicial, meaning they messed my record, like I can't even work. And it's been sealed at Ohio. I'm in Arizona, but it was sealed in Ohio at the state level. But it's all over. I can't even work in healthcare. I'm a social worker by trade, master's level, I might add. And I can't even work because of this. But then I asked them, is there an appeal process? They said, well, you didn't get the letter. I said, no, but it sent it to the wrong address. So I had to send in an appeal 2 years later, and that's what, the last time I talked to you guys, that's what I was telling you about. Some kind of way that I heard, I did it two ways. I sent it certified for them to sign it, and also for them to sign that green card and send it back to me. And I haven't heard anything yet. That was last week. I'm just trying to decide. I guess I'm trying to decide, should I call or should I just wait for the green card to come back?
Yeah, I'm not sure I understand what you said something about an administrative thing. I'm not sure what you're talking about. That might have been Gerard you were talking to, but I don't know.
I don't know, but what it was I had a business, a home care agency in Ohio, and, you know, the employees sign off on the documentation when they go in the home. But if they don't go in the home, and they still sign on the documentation, and I bill it. Well, that's considered Medicaid fraud. So not a big deal. I pleaded to it down to a misdemeanor, and I stayed in Ohio and sealed it up, and it sealed up. But when I went to try to go get a job, I was trying to, I think I was going to go be a social worker.
So you're waiting for an appeal to go through, and was this through administrative courts? But this was through administrative courts?
Right. The guy who I talked to the last time, he said I shouldn't have even went to their appeal process. I should have took it straight to the federal level, but I didn't know that.
It depends on what's really going on. Let me give you an example. For instance, let's say you're an employer, okay, and you play ball with the Department of Labor as an employer, and you pay into their system, for unemployment insurance, whatever it is that they call it. But anyway, you're paying into that process. And so every time someone comes to, you know, is getting a check, you're sending money in quarterly or monthly or however often you're doing it. And then you turn around, let's say, and, of course, then the person goes on unemployment, and then they get to, you know, take unemployment down. Now, once you participate with the Department of Labor, they have an administrative process that you now have signed up into, and you have to go through it, and it is as unjust as anything else out there. But if you don't sign up and you don't agree to an administrative process of that type, they have no control or tie over you, and you can immediately go into a state court.
I didn't know that. See, I didn't know because what happened was it's like a database, and it said that this was going to be happening. Because I read the Rule of the Serious Jurist, the book of that lady who in Oregon, I read her book, and it said that happened in 1995, but she said that there was going to be databases. And what happened was this database went even in the national practitioner, because I'm a licensed social worker. So when
right, so the, because of that, they blackballed you, right? You're telling us that you've been blackballed. You've been added into a list.
Right, and I never was informed that I got this letter. They sent it to a complete different address.
Right.
Well, that right there, it deprived me of judicial due process because I didn't get the letter. It went to a complete different address. So I did the appeal. They told me, I did the appeal process through them.
Right, but here's the problem. Let me give you another example. You know, I've had problems with, for instance, the Department of Labor some years ago. I never participated with them, and they called me in and they wanted to go through my books, and you know, I told them where they can go, and we went through this a couple of times, and they brought me into this administrative process. They called it a court. It was really a kangaroo system. It was really horrible. But anyway, at some point, and this is long before I really understood how things work in the courts. You know, I had a little bit of understanding on certain things, but I really didn't have any knowledge. And I did hire a lawyer just to come in one time and give me some advice. And his advice was, well, look, fight through the administrative process. And when you get to the end, you can then take it into the Supreme Court, you know, which is the New York State Supreme Court. And you could probably beat it there. But so I took his advice. But what he failed to tell me, you know, was that if I lost in the administrative process before, I have to get permission, okay, in order to take this into the court. And before I even could get permission to take it into the court, I had to pay the penalty and the monies that they said that I owed them, okay, before going into that process, you know. So I ignored the whole thing and told them where to go, but they never came out after me criminally, though. But go ahead.
The attorney that I had didn't know what the hell he was doing. I paid $8,000. I paid all the money back when it happened, plus $2,500 to pay for this. I paid $10,000 back, and I still can't even fucking work. Excuse my French. And so I didn't know what else to do. I mean, like, I'm not going to sit down.
Yeah, you're not going to look at you. You're not going to win.
Anyway.
You're not going to win in administrative court. The whole thing is right off the bat. The fact that they're pulling you in, as far as they're concerned, you're guilty. At the end of the day, you're going to be guilty. It's rare to get anyplace else. Unfortunately, it's the same thing even with constitutional court.
Well,
that day doesn't matter anymore.
I'll do what it takes.
Well, you see, again, you're going back into their system through their appeal system,
I don't
and again,
know what
you.
To do.
You
I got to get my name.
It is tough. Well, look. Hold on. Listen. Okay. Look, you could sue them. Go into the courts and sue them because they can't take away your ability to work. You
no,
have an unalienable right. Listen to
that.
Me. Listen. Mm-hmm. You have an unalienable right to work. Okay. And they can't take that away from you, at least not forever anyway, but they can't take that away from you. You can go into the court and sue them, but you have to sue them on an individual basis. Now, here's where you run into problems. You now got to go find a lawyer that's actually going to do it the
I'm
right
not
way.
Get my lawyer. They don't,
right.
I'm not
it's
doing
just going to happen. So the only other option you have is to educate yourself.
That's
and that
what
takes
I'm doing.
Time.
That's
all you can
That's what I'm not going to. I don't trust the lawyer. They're all in bed together.
Yeah, it's a problem all the way around. It's a problem.
I did send it in. I did that process. I called them on it. I asked them. I said, "How the hell do you have my name, but you don't have me? You don't have the correct address, and you're going to say that is lawful." That is
well, look it.
Unlawful.
Write an affidavit and get it to us, and we'll get it into the case. There are certain we're only dealing with people who are really. In danger of going to jail or in jail, and maybe a few other things. It's kind of
got
to make.
I'm not going to go to jail. I stay away from
them. But no, listen. We are taking affidavits for a lot of different things. Certain affidavits we're going to hold off and not put in right away. We may put your affidavit in right away. We may not. I mean, if you're really in danger of going to jail, we're definitely going to put it in. If you're already in jail, we'll definitely put it in. That kind of a thing. But people, let's take for instance people who are. Have problems with a traffic violation. I mean, look, we don't want to get lost into that. As much as they are doing illegal things to people by, charging them with these codes and stuff, which is wrong, but that's not where our battle is at. But there are certain cases that you may not put in right away, but eventually we'd have to look at your case and see. But
well,
do
the
an
one
affidavit,
that, well, the
and then we'll
see
what happens,
one,
at least maybe
the
in the future.
Know. Help. The one thing I know that I can get them on, and I'm going to sue them, and if I have to sue the whole human resources as soon as Medicare or Medicaid, I don't care who gets it. I know this, they can be held accountable for the deprivation of my rights under U.S. one of those.
Well, let me just ask a question. What exactly started this whole thing? What exactly happened?
I just told you. I'm going to try to tell you again. I had a company. Okay, I had an agency,
uh-huh.
A home care agency. I was a CEO. I had people who went out and they would take care of people in their home. It was unskilled.
Okay, got you. I understand.
All you did was you went in as a companion. But I was
okay, and then you when you filed for payments, there were some things that wasn't correct, and
you
had
to
be correct.
If you listen to what I'm telling you, you'll get it. When I filed the billing. I did the billing. Now, I couldn't blame them because I was CEO of the company. I had to take the fall for it, okay? But then I paid all the money back, like $8,000, plus $2,500 for an attorney, and they said they dropped it down to a misdemeanor, and I sealed it at the state level. But what happened is it's called the Inspector, Office of Inspector General. It's under the HAS, Human Resources, which they deal with Medicaid, they deal with Medicare, they deal with all this. It's an agency.
Did they try to turn this into a criminal action?
What do you mean? They say anytime you get addicted, they...
Listen. Did they try?
Who's they?
Hold on. There's other noise in the background. Hold on a minute. All right, look. Did they try to make a claim? Did they claim that this was criminal, or they just? I'm sorry.
The
go
state.
Ahead.
Are you talking about the state?
Well, yeah. I mean, look at if there's no criminal activity going in here.
It was criminal. It was three felonies, and I had it. I had it dropped all the way down to a misdemeanor.
Okay, so you did go into a state court then in
yes.
order for that to happen, okay,
yes.
or a county court. Okay,
county
this was not done in an administrative court. Okay.
No. And all
right, and...
Yeah.
All right, so this happened how long ago?
It happened, I got it sealed in 2015 on the state level.
Okay, so at the end of the day, the conclusion of the court, you were fined or and you had to pay back a certain amount. Well, what happened?
I had to pay back a certain amount of money to the Centers for Medicaid, and I paid for an attorney. And
okay, did the court make a decision of some concern concerning your license?
No, I still have my license.
Okay, so you still have your license, but you can't work
yes.
or you have problems
because whenever they do a background check, it comes.
Well, if the court made a decision,
I talked to them. They said this, even though it was sealed at the state level, that has nothing to do with the federal. Or Inspector of General is feds, the federal.
Right. Look, I hear, this is a situation where you're going to have to sue them, but you're going to have to go in yourself, and you're going to have to learn to be able to go in, yourself. That's the only way that I know that you can deal with this problem. Whatever happened on the case where that went to the state. My point is that somewhere in the penalty, they'd had to have said that we're gonna pull your license or something.
No.
Okay, but they listen to me.
Okay.
I hear what you're saying. I do hear what you're saying. They didn't do that. An administrative court can't do that per se. That was looking from a criminal perspective, and they didn't see it, so they didn't require that to happen. So they can't just put you on a list. So therefore, you can sue them directly. But again, as I mentioned, you're not going to get a lawyer that's going to help.
That.
You. Right.
Glad,
I don't know.
I'm glad you said that. I'm already
scared
to go. I may have to sue the whole. I don't know. There's a way, and I'm praying about it. I'm asked God to lead me because there is a way.
Well, again, you're going to have to get educated, and you're going to have to get real serious about trying to understand how the court system works. And one of the other problems is you're going into unjust courts. Again, you're going to have some other problems. And again, if you take a lawyer to get into there, I'll bet you dollars to donuts, you'll spend maybe whatever you spend, $10,000.
No,
just
I'm
throwing
not
your
saying,
money
I'm not
gonna, no, I'm just
no.
saying. I'm just making that,
yeah.
that point. The
I'm
point is...
You.
It's unfortunate. You see, it's unfortunate because it's already biased against you to go into a court system that's biased against you already. And any lawyer that takes you in already knows that they're going to lose the case most likely, and they're just going to take your money. But again, I can see how you, I can see clearly
but
how you
know
win
what?
This case.
But you know what? I have to
and you should win the case.
I have to believe the Constitution. I have to believe in my rights, my unalienable rights. And I have to believe that my Creator did not expect this from me. And I don't care what anyone says. I don't care what the naysayers say. I don't care what the naysayers say. It's not right, and I'm going to fight. And if I have to make case history, then that's what I will do.
All right. Well, Cynthia, that's what you got to do. And appreciate the call. Thanks.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, write an affidavit, and we'll look at it. Okay.
I mean, you want me to write an affidavit of what I'm sending to the court?
What's going on? But everybody that's given us an affidavit doesn't mean it's going in. We're really choosing mostly cases. Again, we're putting into the court case now. Right now, we're only putting in things where people are injured and they're suffering from potentially going to jail or they're in jail. With being abused in the jail, the real serious problems. Those are the ones we're putting in right now. Doesn't mean that the other ones that are coming in, we may not put them in right away. We first have to spearhead ourselves into the system before we try to push anything else. And then we'll have to consider, when we would put certain affidavits in. But we got to really break through.
I'm not really clear of what kind of affidavit you want. You want me to put down what I said to them or what happened to me?
Well, in your case, I'm not too sure either. Here's the thing. Here's your problem in a nutshell. Okay? You went into a state court on a criminal situation, and at the end of the day, they did not take your license away. Okay?
Mm.
So the administrative courts clearly can't do that either. And you know, you're probably you're on a list, is what it is, and
right.
and somewhere when your license shows up,
it's called an exclusion list.
Right. So who put you on that exclusion list? That's the question you have to find.
The Office of Inspector General.
You go to the Office of Inspector General, and you go, if you can't find the very individual who put you on, you go to the boss, you know, whoever is running that department, that's the guy you go after. And by what authority do they decide that they're going to pull your license when this thing was already dealt with by the courts?
I asked her that on the phone, and she said, because it's the Social Security Act. It is the Social Security Act. I say, yeah, but an act, the Constitution is the supreme law of the land, and that's the Social Security Act. Because then it's the Social Security Act that they created this administrative process to do this to people. They need to have like 6,000 medical professionals on this database, then they can't work.
Right. Well, again, you're right with the Social Security Act and all that stuff. I mean, you know, there is no authority for a lot of this stuff, and of course, any control. Well, again, that's where you got to go. You got
to
go after the individual.
I have to go to the Office of Inspector General.
You have an unalienable right to work. Okay, and the criminal process did not see it that they should take your license. And that's what my argument would be. I would think in a just court, you'd win. You know, if it was something that that my license should have been removed, it should have been done in a court of law.
At the state level.
In the administrative process.
Right.
Right. So it's that simple. That's how I would look at it. You know, you have a right to work. You know?
Okay.
But,
I'm going to have to defend myself. You know, it's so funny because I was actually going to go to law school right after that because I got a second master's in theological studies. And I'm getting ready to go to law school, but something pulled me away from it because I just kept saying, there's something wrong. My spirit kept telling me there's something wrong. And that is what it is. They don't have a right to keep me from working. And they said, we're not keeping you. I said, yeah, but when people look at that, it says convicted of a program conviction. They stay away from me.
They
can't do that. It's against my rights.
Well, you have to learn the process and how the court system works somewhere. You have to understand the paperwork and how the paperwork works and how to file papers
and all that stuff. I've been reading up on it. I'm ready. I'm going to go. I'm going to file some of that paperwork, waiver some of it. I'm going to waive some of in order to go to the high court, I have to have money to file. I'm going to go indigent. I mean, I've been reading. I'm defending myself. I've defended myself in court before.
My point is this, okay? If you really want to learn law at that point, the best thing to do is learn. That my opinion, though, at least it worked for me, and I know a lot of other people it does work for. Because you're not going to learn what you need to learn in bar school, for instance, you know, or you know you learn the and you know again even the process. I think when how the paperwork works. I understand. My brother went to law school, and the bottom line at the end of the day, there are two things because I quizzed them particularly on number one, what did he learn about the Constitution? They said that they brought it up from time to time, but they never studied or learned anything on it at all. Okay, that's one thing.
They never
really studied the Constitution. They never got into the nuts and bolts of the Constitution. I mean, if you're going to go to law school, wouldn't you think that would be the prime part of law school? I'm just giving you. I'm just giving you some information. Okay.
Okay.
The second, and this is in New York. Okay, so the second thing that I discovered from talking with him concerned is that they never really, at least he never learned, maybe some other places he learned, but from when he went to school, you never really learned the real process of the paperwork. When you come out of law school, I think that whole system is set up that way so that you have to go and work for another lawyer and underneath their wing to learn how the paperwork process goes, you know? So again, that is kind of a difficult thing, filing the papers. But the truth of the matter is, at the end of the day, when all is said and done, but again, they're not going to acknowledge this, the only thing necessary to make a prima facie case is an affidavit, period. That's all that You could scratch it on a piece of toilet paper with a paper with a pencil, and get it sworn to and pass it into the court, and they have to accept it and they have to take your case on. Now, of course, they're going to want to give you a lawyer, you know, a bar lawyer, and so on and so forth. And then there are so many arguments you got to make just to get to the point of justice, which you never really get to the case itself, because you're destroyed by trying to find your way into the court and to be able to do it without getting a lawyer. So you could just stick to the facts.
You're right about that. And you know what? I hear what you're saying. But you know what? We serve a – see, the one thing my theology taught me is I serve a mighty God. And you know what? At the end of the day, all of that is just – that's wishwash of man. And the truth is going to be told, and I'm going to be redeemed from this.
I agree. At the end of the day, everything's going to be made right, and that's that. But
yeah,
when that day comes,
because I didn't do anything wrong, it's not right for what they did. But I'm glad the way you explained it to me. That makes sense, because I knew that in my gut. I just didn't really know how to word it. And you worded it exactly right. I told that lady that. This is the lady I spoke with, and she said, I mean, it's like 5 years before I can work. I mean, I'm older. I'm older now. I mean, in 5 years, No.
Mm-hmm.
No, it's not right.
All right, well, Cynthia, I appreciate the call. We'll move on.
I just don't know how to send. I'll just send you an affidavit or.
Just click on. There should be a button. I forget where it's at to put in an affidavit, and. I think it'll give you some instructions, okay? And then the instructions, you'll email it someplace. Someone will look at the affidavit, and they'll help you out with it, make sure that, you know, it's staying to just the facts, and then we'll let you know what we can do, if anything, with it, you know? I mean, your case is kind of, a different kind of situation, because it's not really, you know, you're not in jeopardy of going to jail. And that's the only cases we're filing right now, is ones that are really serious. Of course, people who are losing their property, the non-judicial foreclosures, we're doing that too. But we need to look at the affidavit and make a decision what we're going to do.
Yeah, but I totally appreciate you guys looking at it and taking a look at it. But quite honestly, I can do this on my own, because it's really the rule of court. How you do things in court, how you do the paperwork, and I'm a paperwork queen. I went and got my master's in social work so that I could be part of creating public policy. I am not scared to do this. I think I'm called to do this, and I will do it. So, I mean, but I'm always listening to what, you know, some good, you know, input. I'm always listening to someone else, because, you know, I don't know everything. So.
All right. Well, thanks for the call, Cynthia. We appreciate it. Okay?
All right.
Let's go to the next caller, Fred from California. You got the mic. Go right ahead, Fred. Hey, Gerard, are you almost ready to take the board here?
This is California Fred.
Hey, Fred, how you doing?
Is Gerard ready to take the board?
Yeah, well, go ahead. I'm taking the call right now. I don't know if I'm just trying to see if Gerard's here. I do see him signed in on the board.
I had a comment and a question.
Yeah.
On InfoWars, they had what they called a red pill expo last weekend, I guess it was. But they aired it with Millie Weaver, I believe, on Tuesday or Wednesday this week. Last week. And, they had a guy by the name of Lord Munchkin there, and he was making comments about the FBI guy that lied to the investigators about the LaVoy shooting.
Mm-hmm.
And he says they're going after the Bureau of Land Management if they don't restore Mrs. LaVoy Finnegan's rights to graze cattle. And quit.
Yeah, I saw something somewhere, but who's going to go after them?
According to Lord Munchkin, he made some comments to somebody in the Trump administration. I'm not sure who.
Okay, well, we do know that Donald Trump is very much aware of a lot of that's gone on out there. He was, even before he was elected, he was you know, visiting and sending others out there to get information. And that's how we connected with the president before he was elected president, because he had an interest and he wanted our paperwork. So we've been sharing it with him since. But, you know, one of the things, whenever you get someone with a title like Lord, I mean, he could be a good guy, and, you know, but I don't know, that makes me worried to begin with, Lord something. But, you know, I did see something, I think I read something somewhere concerning that situation with this guy that you're talking about, and it might have been, and you said this was on the Alex Jones show?
Yes, sir, it was called the Red Pill Expo. If you were to... Really,
and that was an article, or was that a video and audio?
It was an article, video article at the Red Pill Expo.
I think that's what I saw. I read an article.
Covered.
Yeah, I read
no,
an
this
article.
Is video.
I think, but...
Now,
okay,
Lord
well,
Munchkin,
I read...
to give you history on him, he was one of the people. He's a very esteemed person in the weather and science. And he was challenging this global peace treaty with London and Paris and the global warming. He was calling it junk science, and the real scientists were challenging it. And they had a climate thing in Germany dispelling all of this global climate crap. And that's where Munchkin really hit the Alex Jones show, was in bringing science opposing the global settled science bullshit. Pardon my French.
He's from England, is he not? He's from England, too.
Yes, that's where he gets the title Lord.
Right, he's very popular there, and he's a very big Trump supporter.
Yeah,
so,
and again, he may be a great guy, good. You know, I just automatically, when I see someone with the name Lord in front of someone, you know, it makes me wonder. But, you know, people accept titles, and it just becomes a title and may not mean what it used to mean. I don't know.
Well, in
rather than being sidetracked by Lord Munchkin, I only brought him up to explain that he felt that he had some inside track with the Trump administration, and he was giving the Bureau of Land Management notice that unless they changed their ways, that very soon they would be set upon by the Department of Justice and people would go to jail.
Mm-hmm.
And not only that, but I was on the internet doing some research, and there's a whole lot of information out there about the Uranium One deal and Congress passing special laws and sweetheart deals and creating mining companies, and even the judge that was sitting on the Lavoie-Vinnikin case and the Bundy case was a member.
All of these elected people, including the judiciary, the appointed, and all of these individuals, and generally speaking, they're all out there selling America. It's all about corporate America. They're selling us off to the highest bidder, so to speak. And that's the problem. So,
John,
you know, there's a lot of valuable land out there.
I heard Gerard's voice, so he is definitely on the board. Now for my question. Did you manage to get anything accomplished, and what's the next shoe to drop in the case?
Which case now? Yours?
The one that you have filed. The one the judge wrote the paper on.
Right. Yeah, well, we did a writ of error. I think it was very powerful. This judge has nothing. Look, there is nothing that I've seen, can see or find anywhere, except for they do this from time to time. When a judge refuses to do the wrong thing and he's kind of stuck in a pickle, so to speak, and he doesn't want to do the wrong thing, and they'll send in the fixer judge, and the guy will do anything. And that's what this is. I mean, look, the judge was picked out of a pool. We made this point. Okay, where's this guy coming out of left field to make some kind of a decision like this? And we made it clear that this is a court of record. It's going to be decided by juries. And also the fact that this was an extraordinary filing. And we've got lots and lots of cases in here. And this guy's just going to come up with a broad statement. And his whole statement was the fact that we were not lawyers, and we made it clear we're not prosecuting this case. We have no intentions of prosecuting this case. What is he talking about? If he would have read the papers, he would have known. But anyway, we did a writ of error. I am confident that that writ of error will stand. And we're continuing to file papers. We'll be filing papers this week and next week, you know, constantly. We've got some non-judicial foreclosures we'll be filing. We also, I'm trying to move forward on getting all of these habeas corpuses that were ignored to do show causes on all of these judges. There's about 30 of them. And they need to answer by what authority. And, you know, they need to respond to their rejection to due process in a court of law to these individuals that they put in jail, you know. So we've got a lot going there on that, and a lot more cases, you know, a lot more we're going to be filing. By the way, my board is standing still. Was that coming through? Gerard, are you there?
It came through fine, but I'm not Gerard. Okay. This is California Fred.
Yeah, but I was... Gerard's mic is open, so he could respond to me. But, okay, anyway, you know, look at, if you read the papers and go through it, there's no way that they're going to be able to throw this case out. We also sent a paper to the president concerning some of this stuff and a copy of all this stuff to a few congressmen, the Judiciary Committee, and, of course, Mr. Trump and so on. Go ahead, Gerard.
Those papers we filed are on the docket, right? We posted those.
We got to double check to make sure. I know Carl's been checking the docket, so we'll get a hold of Carl.
I'm saying they're on our web page under docket.
Oh, yeah.
Those two papers we just recently sent, and they're only out. They're not out 2 weeks yet. They're just over a week.
Right.
Those are on the – they should be on the – Yeah, because it was the writ of error and then the President Trump letter, which, you know, look, everybody knows what's going on now. And and the other thing is like you said before, this case has been open for how many months? 6-8 months? And then he's going to come in and say, you need to be lawyers. We laid it all out in the beginning. If they had any objection to us not being lawyers, that should have been the first thing out of their mouths when we put the case in, and they didn't. So silence is acquiescence. We gave them the law of the case. We laid it all out, what we were doing. And if they had any objections, that was the time to object. You can't come back 8 months later and say, we're throwing your whole case out because you're not a lawyer. I mean, it shows bad form on their part. In other words, they're just looking for anything to get rid of us. It's like saying, you got cooties, so we're throwing you out.
Yeah, we also made... Go ahead.
Go ahead, I'm done.
Yeah, you know, we also made the point that this was going to be brought before the grand jury, and we're kind of discussing that now. Should we go forward and bring a grand jury together and do an indictment? You know, of course, it has to be agreed to, but look for it to get an indictment, and then if we get an indictment, then put it into the court case. We know they're not going to move on it, at least not right now, but it might be advantageous to actually do that right now and put it in there. We won't necessarily look to move towards the arrest right away and to get the trial going. But we could do it, and then we can also I have to think about where we can go from there. But the point is to get that in there might be a wise thing to do right now, number one. At the same time, I think we need to do something – excuse me. We need to do a show cause to the magistrate that's running this case, you know, the administrator of this court, where we've already given him two orders on two cases that, you know, that he's supposed to file some papers on our behalf for because they defaulted, okay, and he needs to move on that. And if we did that at the same time, that may assist each other, put more pressure, because in my opinion, this magistrate has done nothing and is doing nothing because he doesn't know what to do, and he's frightened to go either way. That's what my opinion is. And by putting this show cause into him, giving him 30 days to respond to this on the one hand, also going to achieve an indictment on this other judge for doing what he's doing, which ultimately is trying to conceal, remove, he's subversion, federal, what was the other one, the criminal, there's a couple of criminal charges, as a matter of fact, on this that we were able to pull out of this. But, you know, if we put all that together, that may give us some leverage and put more pressure on this magistrate that needs to be starting to do it, that needs to be starting to do the right thing and starting to make the, you know, respond to his administrative duties. But he's not doing it. He's not yet.
The fact that they defaulted on the clerk and let it lay there all those months, and then we had to send paperwork for this judge to sign, and before this judge signs it, he comes in and kicks that out too and says, oh, and by the way, I'm kicking out the default on the clerk.
But he also said it because we're not lawyers, but he doesn't even understand the case. We're not coming in here with the case. We're not coming in as lawyers. We're coming in as the people, and we're not coming in as the prosecutor. We're coming in as the people making the accusation and making sure that a court of law, a court of justice is going to take place. Look, the grand jury has taken that extra step. You know, when we the people versus whoever, you know, that's usually either state's writer or the United States versus whoever, okay, they're speaking in our name. They're saying that the grand jury, they're saying the people, the grand jury has decided. We're just taking it to the next step to be in that court case to make sure that they don't play the games that they're playing and that they're trying to play right now and just try to get away with the murder, literally, and have these cases thrown out. And I don't think there's a way, I don't think they'll be able to achieve anything to get us thrown out in this way. But, Gerard, you ready to take over the board?
Sure.
Okay, I'm not going to do nothing. Make sure you hit next question, not clear queue.
Okay, Fred, anything? I'm going to kick you out of the queue. You ready?
Yes, sir, I am. Pleasure. Okay. It was a pleasure talking to you guys. I love it. I live for this. Bye.
Okay. Okay. We have Williams from Missouri. Go ahead. You're unmuted. Ashley. You've been unmuted.
Hello. Yes, I'm here. I don't have a question, but I do have some information that may help, members and all, not just members, but all those who need freedoms. I do have a friend that he said he got some documents that, you know, it will help people to, have status. And, you know, but he needs to get to the right hands. He needs to send it out to the president. But, you know, I told him that I will, you know, let you guys know and see what you guys think about that.
Well, I don't know what I think about that. I'd have to see the documents. But, you know, the...
If his documents are status, the only thing in this world that gives you status, okay, is a beating heart of a human being. Case closed.
Okay, so we don't need those documents? Is that what you're saying?
I think I know what you're talking about. I may be wrong, but I think I understand what you're talking about. We got involved in this very early on, trying to figure things when we started to discover we couldn't get anywhere. Oh, it must be. You started listening to people talk about status and standing and all this stuff, and filing papers in the county and doing all these different things. And but really, all that really was doing was empowering the unrighteous codes that they claim as law, or statutes that they claim as law. We were really empowering the people. Okay, when the fact of the matter is this, okay, we the people were created in the image of God, okay, to begin with. We have unalienable rights. So all we need to be is, one, a human being with a beating heart, in other words, alive and able to speak. That gives you standing. That gives you status. Any argument we try to make in order to deflect or to argue against things that they're saying only empowers them. And so that's kind of our position. So I think that's what you're talking about anyway. I'm not sure.
I Yeah, I'm not sure, but he was, you know, he was kind of really urgent. He think that will really, you know, help this, freedom. But I told him that I will, you know, I will get in touch with one of you, and maybe I can give you the number.
Get the information he has, okay? Get it to Jan at nationallibertyalliance.org. He'll take a look at it. Jan, J-A-N, okay?
Okay.
He'll take a look at it. He may have some other national leaders look at it, and then if they feel it should be looked at by myself and Gerard, then we'll look at it, too. But he'll probably share it with me anyway when he gets it. But I think I know what it is that he's talking about. And it's really, you know, again, trying to make an argument on unconstitutional statutes and laws anyway.
Okay. Well, I appreciate it. I will let him know, and he can contact Jan and, give him his information, so that way you guys will get, maybe he can send the forms and you guys go from there.
Yeah, we'll look at it. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Aye.
Okay, we'll go to, looks like Culpepper is next. T. Culpepper, you've been unmuted.
Hi, Gerard.
Hey.
I was wondering if you guys were familiar with this case. It's from the Southern District in 1985. It's in RE grand jury application decided by Judge Broderick. Have you ever heard of that?
I don't know if I have. Tell me more.
Well, I have. That's a New York case?
Yes, it is.
And it's a New York Supreme Court. Well,
no, it's Southern District.
Southern District. Okay. All right. And what is the bottom line on it?
Well, I just want to read you what they say, because it's just like what you're trying to do is that they're trying to channel you into, you know, their system. But it says here, but I just want to read briefly from the statute, 18 U.S.C. 3332A. It says, it shall be the duty of each such grand jury impaneled with any judicial district, special grand jury impaneled pursuant to 18 U.S.C. so-and-so, to inquire into offenses against the criminal laws of the United States alleged to have been committed within that district. Such alleged offenses may be brought to the attention of the grand jury by the court or by any attorney appearing on behalf of the United States for the presentation of evidence. Any such attorney receiving information concerning such an alleged offense from any other person shall, if requested by such person, inform the grand jury of such alleged offense, the identity of such other person, and such attorney's actions or recommendation. Now, this is interesting because a couple of years ago, me and a couple of members of a court watchers group went down to the Southern District, and we tried to hand affidavit to the foreman of the grand jury, and we said it was confidential, only to be opened by the foreman of the grand jury. So lo and behold, a couple of weeks later, we get a form from the Preet Bharara's office, you know, asking us to fill it out. So they just completely ignored what we put in there. Now, what they did was wrong anyway, because they supposed.
Remember that code that you gave me, 18 U.S.C. 1833A. That is really a code or a statute of process and procedure for them. It's not the only way a grand jury is dealt with, okay? But that's the way for the court system to deal with it. They have to write their procedures. And, of course, a lot of it locks things down, and then they think that's the only way that a grand jury could be called upon or be dealt with. But you got to also remember, you're trying to get access to a puppet grand jury, okay? Remember, the grand jury has already been captured. It's captured by the judiciary, which it starts off, first of all, of course, with the prosecutor who has total control over that grand jury, okay? And you can believe a good prosecutor is going to get his indictment every time, okay? And it'll be rare. And like in the other case, what was it? There was the case of that Well, there was a couple of cases in New York that was recent where the grand jury had to actually, where the prosecutor actually went in there and just spent hours on end trying to convince the grand jury not to prosecute, okay? And but they had to make it look good. They had to make, bring that case into the grand jury to make it look good. I'm trying to remember which case that was, but that was one that's maybe in the last 6 months or so. But that's what you got to realize what you're dealing with. You're dealing with a puppet system. You're not going to get any justice out of it. And, you know, we had this situation down in Florida where some members of ours who went off a little rogue on their own, we told them not to do this, and they played the man on the land thing, and the guy got arrested, and they got this grand jury going, and then they tried to get a hold of the foreman on the grand jury. And next thing you know it, these people are being arrested and are running into trouble for tampering with the jury and stuff. There's another case of a lieutenant or something. I forget what his title was, but, you know, he was, you know, I'm not sure what branch of the service he was in. But in any event, he had some information. He wanted to get to a grand jury. And he spent, I think, a year trying to get this information. He couldn't get through. Then they went out after him for goodness. Do you remember what that was, Gerard?
I think they went after him for jury tampering, huh?
No, it was stalking the jury. Okay, and he ended up. He's in jail now for 2 years. Okay, we were trying to work with him also, but he was kind of hard-headed, wanted to do certain things a certain way, and we would not participate in the man on the land stuff or any of those anything that's going to give them any power and authority and to acknowledge them, you know, to play with this idea that we have to run through their hoops and prove ourselves as having standing or this or that or the other thing. but it's a big problem, and I'm sure you didn't get anywhere with it, but go ahead with your story.
Well, here's the thing. I agree with you completely. And you know that this jury is a farce. But the problem is, you know the old saying, perception is reality? Most people
right.
don't know this.
Mm-hmm.
What I would suggest is that everybody who has an injury to go down there and file a complaint and expose the puppet grand jury.
Listen,
go ahead, Gerard.
I just want to say, even by their rules, their statutes, that puppet grand jury, you're supposed to have access, even under the law that's here now. They're not supposed to intercept that letter. That's supposed to go to the foreman. Even under the rule, they don't, in other words, they violated you. They gave it to the federal prosecutor that you said they gave it to Parikh. You got a letter back from Parikh? Bahar?
What's that?
You got a letter back.
Yeah, I got a letter from the Southern District saying, fill out this form.
Oh, I thought you said Parikh.
Wasn't Parikh let go?
Yes.
He was. But
this was then, we are federal court, Southern District. Yeah, he was let go, he looked like a real good guy. He was doing a lot of stuff, but I begin to wonder about that guy because I know there was a few things.
The
New York City police were trying to go after a lot of corruption in the city, and Parikh wouldn't go along with it. But go ahead.
Well, basically, did Gerard, do you want to say something?
No, go ahead. Finish your thought.
No, I was going to say, like I said, perception is reality. Most people don't understand that these grand juries have ulterior motives. Once you prove that you can't get any remedy from these puppet grand juries and people become aware of that, then, you know, they're going to be more open to what you're doing. And I think it'll just prove to everybody that you can't trust the judicial system. It's rigged.
Well, you're right. That's why we are just pulling so many cases all across America into one place here in the Northern District of New York, okay, up here in Albany, and pouring in all kinds of stuff there to show the corruption in the court system. Now, anybody that wants to do that on an individual basis, I can assure you, once you go up against the establishment, and they see that you're one or two people and that you're easy to squash, they're going to squash you. and even to go after you criminally in order to stop you and to make you, you know, an example to others. And anything you do get through and into the system will eventually be just laundered out. It'll be swept and gone. They're not going to allow anything to stand. It's a shame that that's the way it works, but it is the way it's happening. You just can't look at. We have discovered you can't get justice in the courts. We've been in the county courts, we've been in the town courts, and the village courts, which have no power or authority. Okay, we've been in the state courts, the Supreme Courts, we've been in the appellate courts, the Court of Appeals, we've been in the federal districts all across this nation, and we have not found one place where we can get justice. Not one place. Okay, so that's why we did what we're doing. You know, it was early on. It took us a year before we realized what our real plan needed to be, because we started doing this in the state, and we realized we need to be in the federal level. And then once we got to the federal level, it didn't take long before we realized our end game was to get right where we are right now. This was our end game, to get into the courts, to build up a membership and people that have a basic understanding of what we're doing, that would participate from every state of the union. So you have credibility, trying to educate people as best we can, putting an educated site up, having our meetings on Monday to keep things active, getting committees going. All of this was in order to get to the point where we have some credibility to file a court case, which we did in December of 2016. I think it was late in December, before Christmas. We filed this case, which we have been pouring papers into since then. We have hundreds of papers we have filed in this case, and we have lots of cases and lots of more paper to file to put into this case. But we brought it all, you know, we're going after judges in California, Texas, Montana, it doesn't matter where they're at, and we're bringing them here. The whole case is being brought into one place up here in the Northern District of New York, and the reason for it is we're proving and showing subversion against the United States of America by enemies both foreign and domestic. These judges are subverts. They need to be removed from office, and they need to go to jail. That's what our jails were really built for those people. They need to go there.
Well, that's the other thing that I found shocking, is that all these cases that you filed and prosecutor or attorney looking at these didn't find one meritorious case that they could that might compel prosecution?
Oh, no. We're not permitting them to do anything. We'd get one U.S. attorney that filed on behalf of the state for the governor. I mean, what a joke that was. And
I know.
You know, that guy, I don't know, he just wasn't so bright. Because, begin with, we weren't even going after the governors at that point in time. But in any event, and he did a letter. They don't even have the common decency to put something on a piece of paper and make it official and put it into the case. They do it by letter, you know. But look at, we're not looking to do a prosecution on ourselves directly. We are looking to get prosecutors, and we're going after Jeff Sessions, the Attorney General. We've been communicating with him now for quite a few months, and it is incumbent upon him to send down a couple of hundred prosecutors. I mean, goodness, with this thing, with the Russian thing, which there's no evidence of, okay, I mean, what was it I heard? 430 attorneys are all working on that case? Goodness, if they can put 430 attorneys on that case, we need 430 attorneys on our case right down here in New York. And we're just really, this is the tip of the iceberg of what we're putting in. We've got so much to put into this court case, so many violations going across every state of this union by these people who are subverting our Constitution, subverting our nation, subverting the people, subverting their subverts. But,
well,
the
opinion says that the plaintiff do not seek to compel the U.S. attorney to prosecute the named defendant. Rather, they seek to have either the court or the United States attorney present certain information to the grand jury.
Okay,
so,
that's on your case?
Well, no, I haven't done this yet, but, but that's what I'm saying. This is the opinion of the Judge Broderick.
Oh, okay. Well, again, you know what opinions are like, right? We don't need to get into that discussion.
Yeah, I know. Everybody's got one.
Okay? Right, yeah. So, but look, who cares about an opinion of a judge anyway? Good or bad, I really don't care. Right. It means nothing to me. Precedent. Look at this. There's so many rogue judges out there. We have argued with the state on numerous occasions, and they've brought up this one case. It's a New York case by some rogue judge who decided that you know, it was actually an appellate court, I believe, who decided that the common law was abrogated in New York. I mean, they decided, these judges. I think it was three. How many judges were on that panel? It was five judges or something, Gerard, do you remember? I forget the name of the case.
Three were dissenting and four were astounding.
And they made the point that they didn't have the power or the authority to do it anyway, right?
Yeah, the dissenting judges wrote a very good opinion, and when they gave us that case, we turned around and said, look, we agree with the dissenting judge, and we're the people, our opinion counts more than yours, and you're wrong, and he's right, this is unconstitutional, because they said, you can't do this, this is unconstitutional. So who cares if four unconstitutional judges got together and made an unconstitutional ruling, and you had three judges pointing the finger at them going, that's unconstitutional, you can't do it. And the fact of the matter is, it is unconstitutional. So the fact that they had one more judge that went with them didn't make them any more right now, did it?
And it would also be something...
No, I'm just pointing out their hypocrisy.
It would also be something only in New York, or even just in the New York district that they're talking about. I mean, it's really dumb. The point is this, is we don't quote any court cases that are made by federal judges. We may quote good decisions, and there are quite a bit of them, okay, to use that as leverage and to help us, of the United States Supreme Court, okay? Other than that, all these other courts, in my opinion, are irrelevant. It doesn't mean anything because it has nothing to do with the case at hand. First of all, it's all about the facts. Every case is different to begin with. And when you're taking a case that is real, that's being fought under a court of record, in other words, with the jury gets to decide everything, what the law might be, what the penalty might be, what's required for restitution, innocent or guilt. They get to decide it all. Who cares about a stupid judge? They don't have the power or the authority. And if they're ruling in a case that's criminal or something, I mean, they don't have the power or the authority to do that either, you know? They can't make certain statements. Let's say even if it is a jury case, and then they come out and put an opinion on that or something. I don't know how this all works, but I presume most of these cases are where a single judge comes out and makes a decision, and it may be an appellate court might, play around with that. Because remember, you know, you can't appeal court of record. So anything that's coming out of the appellate courts is really coming out. It's not coming out. It shouldn't be coming out of anything criminal anyway. You know, you know, again, these are just rogue people wanting to get their will done. I don't know. But was that case pro or con to our what
pro
we're doing?
Access to
it
the
was
grand
pro.
Jury.
Okay. Yeah. And again, I wouldn't even use it. You know, personally, I wouldn't. United States versus Williams. There's a case with power and authority.
Oh, yeah, that one.
You know?
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, that's power, that's authority, and that's something we can hold up, and it frustrates these people, these judges. You know, bear in mind, you know, when they say we don't have the power, the authority to come together as the people, bear in mind, the question to them is, well, who brought together the first grand jury that's known on record that we know about? That brings us to the Magna Carta, doesn't it? The people got together and did it. So...
Okay, well, I appreciate the answer. Have a good night.
Just be careful, though. Careful what you're doing, because they'll try to go after you criminally if you try to really push too hard to get contact with the jury. And remember, if
you
push
too
hard to do that, it may not even be worth it because, again, they're controlled. But go ahead, what?
No, it's funny you said that because two members of our court watchers groups were assaulted in a courthouse and charged with... And but the funny thing about it is that the state's case completely fell apart. And
look
so
what happened in the Bundy's case. What happened in the Bundy's case when the lawyer stood up and said, "Hey, you know, you got to get these guys go free right now," and the federal the Fed said no, that they were going to hold them, and the lawyer wanted to see the papers. You know, show me the warrant. Show me that you know you can hold this guy, and they refused to do it, and then. They went after this guy right there in the courtroom and tased him. The judge done nothing.
All of these
nothing.
Federal tickets are scams.
Mm-hmm.
It turned out
there was no warrant.
John?
I'm sorry?
Turned out they didn't have any paperwork.
No, they didn't.
Right.
They had nothing.
They
no, otherwise they would have produced it.
What are they going to do? Oh, I guess we better tase him, shut him up. But anyway.
Yeah, we found that out the hard way.
Yeah, right. But anyway, thank you for that.
Where was CNN on that one?
Yeah. Well, somebody
okay, I yield.
Terry, there was a,
what?
There was a company that made a good documentary on it, a big company. They did a nice job, I saw it.
I'm sorry, were you talking to me?
I think they did a documentary. I think it's called America Rising.
We've taken those videos for evidence into the court. We've got them for that. Yes,
that was a
I
very
think, yeah,
good
I think you're right. Three parts to it. It was a very good document.
It was actually like
very
10
good
parts.
I'll look
yeah,
it
I
up.
Don't remember. But we got them all. Whatever number of parts there were on that, we did get them all down. We have them. We're bringing them in as evidence.
But that was a major media company. It was very unusual that you, that was a company that, you know, that was no backwater little company that did that.
Right, very professional.
Yeah.
You thought you were watching 2020 or something.
Exactly, yeah. So, look, every now and then somebody does get through to the grand jury, but I think you're going to be like 1 in 1,000. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's dangerous.
Yeah, it is dangerous. You're right, because they really don't want you. That's their inner circle right there. That's sacrosanct for them.
Well, that's kind of my point, because I was indicted by a grand jury, and my accuser was never even appeared before the grand jury, which is kind of peculiar because she lived in the same county as the grand jury, and you wonder why wouldn't the prosecutor or the grand jury ask for her to testify. I mean, people are just so naive. They're so brainwashed. They don't understand that the prosecutor and the judge have alternative agendas, which is to steal everything that's not nailed down.
Well, even in their statutory world, you have the right to talk to the grand jury or your lawyer. They call it a defendant information packet, and it's supposed to go to them. And they're not all doing it. I mean, there was a nice little interview down in Harlem with the grand jury with this guy, and he said, "Oh, we get the information packet, this and that." And the lady who was a trial lawyer for 35 years, she says, "I've been a trial lawyer for 35 years, and I have yet to have a grand jury ask me for a defendant information packet. I have to push them on them. They don't want them." He said, "Really? We do it all the time." So they do run different in different communities, because some of this stuff has been done since the beginning, and they're still holding it. Like, you find different places where they kind of stuck to the old rules. And like that community in Harlem, I think they've just been doing it that way, and nobody got in there and subverted them. You know, it was a pretty good interview. I think his name was Boykin, Charles Boykin. He was a black guy that had been a grand jury foreman like 4 or 5 times, and then they had another lady who was a talk show host that was an attorney that was becoming a judge, and this other 35 year trial lawyer, and very eye opening. And down in Harlem, New York, trying to explain to people how the grand jury works. And we found out right there in that interview that there's problems with the grand jury system, just based on that alone, that the lawyers don't have access to them when they're supposed to have, the defendant's lawyer, or the defendant for that matter. You're supposed to be able to confront them and give your story. But
I know.
We know that happens.
Everything's rigged.
Okay.
Are you
done? Okay, thank you. Okay. Next question. California Marge, go ahead.
California Marge.
How you doing?
How you doing? This is Margie from not California, I'm North Carolina.
Oh, North Carolina. My eyes.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
That's okay. That's okay. That's all right, Gerard. I'll forgive you. My question is, I like your laugh. I was reading the paper under the docket. It's 1024, unlawful order to dismiss. And, you know, I'm listening to all this, everything you guys are saying. But, you know, I think it was four pages. So all it kept saying was, okay, this jury foreman, he's not a lawyer. And it's about the $400. I guess you were, can you explain that to me, what that paper is really about? It was about the $400 trying to get, I guess, get the money back, because when we filed in the Northern District of New York, you know, we're just trying to get the money back because it's not right what they did. And he keeps saying that you're not a lawyer, you know, you know, the judge. And so can you explain it to me?
Well, the $400 that we demanded back was...
Yeah, I think that was mentioned in the decision that this judge tried to make. She's talking about the order to dismiss the case, and we did respond. We did a writ of error on that, which was 1024-01, if anybody wanted to read those two papers. 1024 and 1024-01 on our docket page. But go ahead, Gerard.
Yeah, well, John, look, we addressed that. When basically what we did was we gave the clerk a show cause she's not supposed to be charging for justice, and she defaulted on it. They never answered. You know, we gave it to the court that she should not be charging the people to come in to report crimes, and they defaulted. So when this judge came in, he tried to throw our case out for not being attorneys, and he wanted to also throw case out against the clerk all in one fell swoop, which really kind of shows what kind of a guy he is, that he let this thing sit there in default, and that we've been in there all these months and nobody said we weren't attorneys. You know, we told them we're not attorneys. We told them we're the people coming in. And if they had a problem with that, the day we put the paperwork in, within a week of that, within 10 days, within a month of that, within 2 months of that, within 6 months of that, somebody should have said something, and they didn't. And under law, silence is acquiescence. So this guy's coming in like, oh, you're not an attorney. You just figured that out, and we told you that in the first three lines of our paperwork. You know, if that was a problem, they should have never let us file then, right? They got clerks over there and everybody else checking the paperwork, make sure it's done right. Now, if we had to be attorneys to come in and put the case in, they should have kicked it out at the front desk. And if they didn't kick it out at the front desk, shortly by the time it got in front of the judge, he should have read the paperwork, and he should have known well long before now, because we spent pages and pages telling him who we are and by what authority we're coming in and how we're operating. It was no mystery. We weren't hiding it. You know what I mean? We laid it right out front. So, you know, like anything else, you know, if you got a contract and stuff and it's all laid out there and you sign it and you don't object, then guess what? You just consented. You know, they do that to us every day. Now we're doing it to them. Their silence was consent. You can't turn around after you consent and then go, oh, I didn't mean to. You know what I mean?
Sure. But now what happens next? You know, are they going to give us the and then they said you have 30 days to, you know, throw it back at you. You have 30 days to when you get a lawyer or whatever. Now what's going to happen next? Will we get the $400 back? What's the next step?
Well, look, we gave him a writ of error and we went after the judge. He needs to answer that. Will they answer it? I don't know, but you know, at some we're gonna put an indictment on him. Somebody's got to answer, and the judge that's on our case, the magistrate who they assigned us, we have two papers that he needs to sign within the next couple of days. It's going to be 30 days, and when he doesn't do that, we're going to send paperwork to him to show cause why he didn't sign it. This is all going to be pressure on them. They can't leave that stuff sit and not answer it. So when we send in a show cause as to why he's not doing his job, And even that other judge who came into the case, who wasn't even a judge on the case, you're supposed to draw them from a pool. I mean, our original judge never took leave of court. You don't just switch a judge in the middle of the stream like that and don't talk to anybody. Look, there were lots of things wrong with his paper. He obviously is not aware or not very smart or something. Somebody grabbed him and said, please fix this because you're our fixer. He said, we were asked to look at this. Well, wait a minute. Who asked you to look at it? That's an ex parte communication. If the other side asked him, the governors and everybody else that we sent paperwork asked him to look at it, it should have been put in a motion so that we could respond to it. If they put a motion and say, we want this dismissed because such and such and such and such, we have to have the opportunity to say, no, you can't give him that motion because they have no authority. The judge has no authority. We're the grand jury. They didn't even give us that opportunity. So what he did it by his words is he admitted that he accepted, they call it a letter motion. What the hell is a letter motion? I have no idea. That's not an official, this is something that these judges and attorneys are trying to get through because they want to keep stuff off the record. It says by letter motion, they did that to us when we sued the Board of Election. Oh, Ms. Galvin responded by letter motion to the judge. And we said, what do you mean letter motion? Call it what it is, by ex parte communication. You know, you send the judge a letter. He's supposed to sanction you for contacting him outside of the court without the other side knowing. It's called ex parte. So he basically condemned himself by his words. So he's not following any procedures or anything else. He's outside the law, this guy. He's rogue, and we're going to make that point. And, you know, I don't know who the chief judge is, but at some point we may even go up and give the chief judge some paperwork to straighten his employees out as far as, you know, what's going on, their policies and procedures there. He's got a magistrate that's so quiet that it's deafening, and then he's got some judge that comes in who has no authority, and the other judge doesn't take leave of court and makes all these rulings and throws the case out based on what? Because we're not attorneys? You know,
sounds like they're just playing games. They're just throwing it all around.
That's right. Well, they play games as long as you let them play games. You know what I mean? So
the next step is we're going to hold their feet to the fire. What did you say the next step was? The next paper to Gibson?
We already held their feet to the fire by sending the writ of error. See that writ of error? That's on record. We sent it into the case. They can't throw it out. It has to go on record. And if you read that writ of error, it's pretty powerful. And if they don't answer that writ of error, that's not going to look too good. You know, and we sent a writ of error, and we also sent a letter to the president, you know, requesting that he watch this case and send us prosecutors and that stuff too. So there's a couple things that we did that's going to weigh heavy on them. So we got to get right now. We're just waiting for their response. You know, look, it's only been hasn't been 2 weeks since we sent it in, so I don't expect.
Okay, what number is that, Gerard? I want to read that one too. Is that 10? This one's 1024, the unlawful order to dismiss. I read that one. It's very good. They're all very good. And John, you do a good job, papers.
It's the last two. One is a letter to the president, and the other one was the writ of error. That's the last two things we filed.
Okay.
And we may send in two more. I don't know yet. John was talking about what our next step is going to be as far as what we're going to send in. The thing is, it would be nice to know if they're going to respond before we send something in, but we don't have to wait. It would be, you know, they don't like to respond because every time they respond, they get a black eye. We, you know what I mean? We hit them really hard. And I think they look stupid because they come in and they do stupid things, and then we call them out on their stupid things, you know?
They're ignorant. And I think we do need to try to start the indicting, you know, start that process.
Well, that's our next step, is to throw an indictment there, especially on this judge, you know what I mean? And the only way they're gonna forestall that is if he comes around and changes it and apologizes and reverses the order or does the right thing, which I don't know that they'll do that, you know? I mean, maybe they will and will fall on the floor, but it would be nice. We'll see.
Well, that was my question. Thank you. And you're all, you know, I appreciate you, Gerard and John, and all these papers are very, very powerful. And we just have to keep fighting and hold their feet to the fire. And I just wonder if they're ignoring our habeas corpus and all that as well.
Well, that's what they do. But look, at you know, they're not used to this. They're not used to people coming back and answering them the way we do. And so I'm sure that they're, you know, a little off kilter, pushed back on their heels now. So we'll see where they go next, you know. But I can't see them not answering us. I don't imagine that that's going to happen this time, you know.
Okay. One other thing.
We'll send them a show cause that they have to answer. That's a case that they have, that they can't ignore a show cause, you know.
Okay.
So, and then we'll, you know, we'll put this judge in the case, and we'll add him to the case, and he'll have to recuse himself. They'll have to get somebody else. I mean, he was never in our case. We don't even know where he came from. You know, I mean, he could be a janitor for all we know. But anyway, okay.
Okay. One other thing. What do you know anything about Rod Class? He's a private attorney general in North Carolina. He's also a bounty hunter.
We know him. We've had conversations with him.
Go ahead.
We were going to work with him, and he got in some trouble, and they arrested him. You know, he had a gun on him. We know the whole story. I don't know what he's doing lately. He got out of jail, and he started teaching his classes again. So I don't know what he's doing right now. You know, he went to D.C. and had a case in D.C., and, of course, they arrested him out of his truck because he had a pistol with him, which I would have never done, but he was pushing the envelope, so.
I think he's winning his cases. He's going to come to North Carolina, I think, in October, another case, October, November. And he's doing it administratively. He's doing it, the strategy a little bit different. They're a corporation and all. He's using, you know, is a corporation, and he's filing papers that way. And because they're, what's he using? They're corrupt. They're
going after the corporate charter and all that stuff. I mean, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. He does it administratively. He does it at the administrative level.
Right, right.
What's it called? Extortion. He's trying to get him for extortion because they get money from the federal government and everything, all these, you know, all the corporate people, you know, the police officers, all of them. So he does it administratively, and he is the prosecutor. He's going in as the prosecutor, but he's going at the administrative level, you know, not through the judicial system.
He discovered some laws on the books that allow a citizen person to bring cases in that are for the benefit of the people and run them as their own private attorney general. I mean, you still have to get some cooperation from the court or it doesn't work. And you got to give him credit. He's out there slugging every day, and he's been in jail a couple times, so he's put his licks in. So it'll be interesting to see how he comes out, you know?
I mean, really like him. Yeah, he's good.
They recognize him as a private attorney general that can actually bring a case from the people in. And he's in a court. We wouldn't hesitate to use him if that was the case.
Okay.
You know what I mean? So we definitely would have dialogue with him at that point. I don't know if he's perfected it. I haven't followed him for over a year now, so I really don't know where he's at or what he's doing. But you know, we're always kind of keeping an eye on that stuff. But he does know who we are. We have talked to him, so we've had contact with him. And having success, we would certainly, you know, team up with him if we thought it would be good. You know what I mean?
Okay, because he is a private attorney general, so could we use him as a prosecutor for these cases?
Well, I don't know if he's at that point yet. You know what I mean? He's a private attorney general, but I don't know if he would run the kind of case we're doing or not. I mean, he knows what we're doing. We've talked. I mean, he's seen our paperwork, so he. You know, I mean, Like I said, I don't know where he is with his methodology. I know that he's been through a school of hard knocks and taken his lumps for it. You know what I mean? So if he's figured it out or he has some court that's actually listening to him, if you can get your foot in the door of a court, that's a major thing. I don't care where it is. It's nice to be in the federal court because then that ruling would apply for everybody. But even if you were in a state court and they let you come in and get your foot in the door and win a case, that's a start, because what you want to do is you want to come in under common law, under Article 3, you know what I mean? You want to get out of their corporatocity court. You know, you want to go in under the Constitution. And he is constitutional. He understands that. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, you know, I don't know. I'll take a look and see what he's doing. I haven't heard of any major victories with him, but I'm sure, you know, that we will hear about it if he has success. You know what I mean?
Okay. If you will, you know, look into it, please.
Yeah.
Sometimes
you can have success in an area.
Uh-huh.
And we've had other people and attorneys that have won in a court, like in an IRS case or whatever. But what happens is because they fought it statutorily and won, they go back. As soon as that person wins, they plug that hole. They change the statute. They do whatever they have to do so it never happens again in that situation. You know what I mean?
Yes,
I think that's what Larry Beecraft did. He painted them into a corner with their own statutes, and they lost. He got them in the horn dilemma where they couldn't move left or right, and he won. But he hasn't won since, because whatever he did, they fixed that problem. You know what I mean?
Make another law. Someone makes a law, and then...
Statutes, another statute. They plugged the hole he used, and they put some other statute in. So now you're back to square one again with them. You know, that's why we try not to fight them, you know, using their statutes. Not to say that we wouldn't, you know, because when they blatantly break one of their statutes, they have no defense for that. So you have them, you know. And so, you know, a lot of times they go in and fix the statute or, you know, they don't do that again. Okay?
Okay. All right. Thank you, Gerard.
You're welcome. Good talking to you.
Good talking to you.
Yeah, have a good night. Okay, we have Harley from Vermont next. Are you there?
Hey, Gerard.
How you doing?
It's Harley. Can you hear me?
I hear you. You sound almost all right.
Well, I got a hold of the affidavit just yesterday. Realized it was in my mailbox for the lady who called early in the...
Okay.
Thing. And there's some serious gang stalking going on here. You know, it looks like her, the relative of the husband, the niece or whatever the hell it was.
Yeah, the niece, yeah.
They were laying for her. And the fact that she worked in a court, you think about that just for a minute. Okay. So in the continuation, her current situation, which alarms me, is that she's got the same lawyer from the niece calling to tell her that he's got a way to check in the court. He found out that she still has this warrant, and we heard her talk about running around checking to see if this really exists, some kind of a warrant, right?
Yeah.
It's a private deal in their own little private club, okay? Because, on the heels of that, he says, well, all you have to do is sign over to me your father's house that you own with your brother. So there's still essentially fruit on her tree. That's why they are trying to come after her and unceremoniously throw her in jail.
Well, wouldn't you think if they had a warrant on her, they would exercise it? I think it's all smoke and mirrors. I think it's a lie.
I do, too. And I think the fact that you promulgate a lie like that as somebody who's a member of the bar, even their own code should scare the hell out of, you know, anybody who who's revealed to do that, right? It's like I told her she should. And the lawyer from the niece is going over and stealing things out of said house of the dead father.
So it's uglier than ugly. You know, she wants to leave, and they told her she couldn't leave because there's a warrant. I told her if she doesn't have anything in writing, she should just leave.
Yeah, she should be out of there, because if their cops execute any kind of a shady warrant like that, then it proves that they're, you know, part of the conspiracy, shall we say. They probably belong to some secret societies together.
Okay, if there's no warrant, really, and she leaves, they won't bother to try to extradite her. I don't believe there's a warrant. I think that's a lie. I don't think any judge has a warrant against her. And, you know,
here's the thing that's so crazy is that, you know, if they either scare her into leaving or scare her into bullying her brother to, you know, help her sign everything over to the lawyers, I mean, the lawyers have gotten, like, between everybody who asset stripped her several times in a row, have gotten about $700,000. So she was a soft target. She's not a highly educated woman. Doesn't, you know, battle with them on their same level. And I think she was a sitting duck. I think they've been setting her up. And I also told her she should talk to her sheriff about that, pillaging going on and that pressure on the father's estate, you know. But otherwise, I'd like to bring it to the Brain Trust to see how to help her. She's got a 2-page basic affidavit that makes fairly good sense, you know, would correct a couple of grammatical things, but, you know.
Well, she's on the right track if she's got an affidavit in, and we will certainly pursue that the best we can to bring paperwork into her case to see if we can help her. But I don't think that she should stay around there if she's got a safe place to go. I don't see why she can't fight this from some place where they don't know she is. You know what I mean?
Well, since every time she opens her mouth in court, they accuse her of, you know, this paper tiger of contempt, you know, and in the fact that they pushed it to be criminal contempt when it was in civil probate kind of court over assets, okay? And then her lawyer went in, this part of the affidavit, her lawyer went in and at least converted it from criminal to civil contempt. But, I mean, what's the damn difference? The jail's the jail. And it's all done completely unlawfully just to get her out of the picture so that they can go about, you know, asset stripping. So, you know, I mean, if nobody else, she's got one asset left, and that's the father's house, and the brother is on it too. And the brother, if he can, I think he should be filing a protection order with the sheriff or something to keep this. Supposedly this lawyer has come and stolen things, and the lawyer wants her to sign over the thing so that he will make this warrant go away. You talk about some hocus pocus.
Yeah, it's a shame that this is typical in the United States. You know what I mean? It's like, it's really bad. And we're getting all the bad stuff. You know, I mean,
it's the class warfare. And, you know, they've got a gang, you know, and they met in secret. I mean, essentially, they got somebody who pretends to be your lawyer. They go up there with something about testimony cards or something, and then they, you know, pass resolutions and stuff. It was like what they were trying to do to Crystal, just have her trial away from her, you know. And anyway, so I'm just... I know that the long haul version is get it into our big case where we're trying to convert a court into a real Title III and get constitutional. But I think they're, without quote unquote giving legal advice, we're just a group educating each other, right? I think there's some kind of other remedy in the cards. She needs to be proactive. She needs to start prosecuting. And I told her to go straight to the ACLU. I mean, if they're throwing you in jail because you're arguing your case to, you know, your own interest of your assets and stuff, and you can't even keep a lawyer, they try to fine her lawyer $400,000. The only one who stood up for her got fined by the court $400,000. He immediately dropped her. And then they probably dropped the fine.
Right.
I mean, you talk about collusion.
Yeah, it's bad stuff, no doubt.
All right. Anyway, I just wanted to put that out there for the Brain Trust and try to talk to a bunch of people and, you know, try to help her get a few decent, you know, make sure that her affidavit has enough substance to it. And if she needs to add anything, you know, send anything else in. We'll talk to you guys later offline about all that.
Right. Hey, thank you, Harley.
Yeah.
Okay, next question is, I don't know, it's got 5680 it ends in. You've been unmuted. 5680.
Yeah, okay. I just wanted to, let me go off speaker, probably sounds better. Fred out there was talking about Lord Munchkin. That's really Lord Montbaum, and I've heard him talk. And I thought the same thing John did. Somebody's got a title of Lord coming out of the country of the British Empire. You have to wonder about it, what his motives are. So, and
well,
go ahead.
They still got people in England like Prince Henry and Queen Elizabeth, and they tell you they're just figureheads, but what's his name there? The son is flying jets at the military, so I don't know how much of a figurehead he is. They have influence, and they still go by those titles because they were titles of nobility and military. So he, you know, they're just a different culture than us. You know, he's a lord. You know, what does that mean? It doesn't mean anything to us, but in his country, it gives him a certain amount of credibility, I guess. You know, all that stuff was a birthright back then. You know, you a lot of times you got into a position because your father was and you inherited it. So I think this is a hangover from that. And I think it's just his culture. I don't think he's a bad guy. I mean, he's, you know, he's all for what Donald Trump's doing. And in his country, when he talks, people listen. You know what I mean? Now, he doesn't have to call himself Lord, but, you know, he's an older guy and he probably had respect when, you know, back in the 30s and 40s, when he called himself Lord, he was probably a lot more respected than today would be. You know what I mean? Because I think they are basic, more figureheads than anything.
That's good information. Fred was talking about the woman who has the administrative court problem about her job and all that stuff. I wonder if she's ever seen USC 5. Section 559, if you look in the notes, it mentions, anybody's got a computer can pull that up pretty quick, but it says right there in the notes, it says that that's about a minute, it's 5559 is about administrative procedures. And it says right there in the notes that statutes cannot derogate the Constitution.
Imagine that. That's good.
So
that's a statute that we might use.
Well, if you haven't seen that, you should pull it up and look at it. So, because that gets the person into the area of, well, what about this, folks? You know,
we have Supreme Court cases that say that too, by the way.
Right. Well, I wondered if that was where John, you know, John has always said statutes, you know, are unconstitutional. So, and I wondered if
statutes are not unconstitutional. Statutes.
Well, statutes can only be applied to the government operation. So
there you go. Exactly. When they try to apply them to us, then what they're doing is violating our constitutional, you know, our unalienable rights, I should say.
Right. And so if you start reading the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, all that, start applying yourself, then you see, okay, it all makes sense. And here it is, 5559 in the notes says, you know, if it's unconstitutional, it doesn't apply the statute.
Exactly.
So, and that's it.
Well, that's a good one to know, because you put it in there and it gives you a little bit more, you know, a little more meat to your argument. You know what I mean?
I have seen court authorities talking about that, you know, statutes only apply to government entities, et cetera, et cetera. So,
well, you try to tell a law enforcement official that, they look at you like you got three heads. What do you mean you don't have to obey statutes? They live and die for their statutes, you know?
Gotcha. Okay, that's it.
Thank you.
I know what else I was going to say. It was this federal judge that came in New York in the case, you know, First Amendment, the end of it, it says that that the people can assemble, peaceably assemble, so that's a plurality, and then they can redress their grievances. Right there is like, you know, your counter to what that judge is saying. You're an association, we're an association, and we have to have a lawyer. Well, it says right here in the First Amendment that we the people, you know, can assemble, plurality, and, you know, can redress our grievances. So, and so whatever that judge is up to is...
Well, are you familiar with Robert Schultz?
Not really.
Robert Schultz... was a guy from New York here that's you know, had run a lot of cases in the New York State Supreme Court, but he went up to the federal court, and he also did what they call the Articles of Freedom. He rented that island where they came out with the Federal Reserve Act, and he got a bunch of delegates throughout the United States lawfully, legally elected by their in their counties. And they drew up, kind of like what our forefathers did, a redress of grievances and the remedy thereof, and had them printed and sent out, you know, to all the Congress and the President and everything. And one of the main ones was, he said, look, the First Amendment has been defended. It's three pieces to the First Amendment. But the one piece that was never tried in a court of law was the redress of grievance. Do the people have the right to sue the government and redress their grievance, and what does that mean? And so when he took it to court, the ultimate decision, they said, yes, the people have the right to a redress of grievance, but the government doesn't have to respond.
So, yeah, as long as it's not affecting what we're up to, it's okay.
It's like saying, yes, the people have the right to vote, but we don't have to count the votes. You know what I mean? It's so ludicrous. And so
you're talking about a judge. This is Jekyll Island, and he lived in the 1800s, or
no. He in
Schultz.
Jekyll Island is off of North Carolina. He rented.
My mentor in life lived there while he was engineer on the Apollo.
He rented the facility on Jekyll Island to do these Articles of Freedom. Had it televised. And I
what
think
time
they came
period?
Out, like 90-something. That was about, it was a couple
of... Not that long ago, then, okay.
Not that long ago. No. And then he went all over the... He went to Congress and the Senate and the White House, and he dressed up with the, you know, V for Vendetta, the mask, the one that Anonymous uses.
Oh, okay, sure.
All the people that were with him went there with that mask on. They were so nervous. They wouldn't come out of the building. They're looking at him up through the windows. And then the guards started busting his chop because he had the plastic swords. It was funny. They're like, I got to see what weapons you got there. And he's going, it's just a plastic sword. The guy said, oh, put that down. It was really silly. You know,
is Schultz still alive, or is he deceased now?
No, he's alive and kicking. I mean, he's around. He still has his foundation.
Yeah. The
IRS is going after him now, and I don't know how he's doing with that. You know, they hate him. They want to get rid of him. He's another thorn in their side. He's another chink in their armor. You know, they're suffering the death of 1,000 cuts, and make no mistake about it, he's a cut to them. He's caused them lots of problems.
It's starting to sound like, say, 1760 or something, where they're talking to the king, you know, we don't like this, we don't like that, we don't like the other, and, you know, in one ear and out the other.
He followed exactly what our forefathers did with their redress of grievances. He did everything according to the way it was set up back then, and reproduce that, and reassemble the Continental Congress, because they said anytime it needed to be opened up again, the people could reopen it, and that's exactly what he did, you know. And so there is a document sitting in there, and he addressed everything, the paper money, you know, all the things they were doing. Now, some of the stuff, now that we know what we know, we could have written it, some of it, better, but it's not a bad document, you know. So basically, he went through the whole process of having people elect delegates to bring to this conclave over here on Jekyll Island, and they spent weeks. And he brought experts in to explain to them what money is and paper money and all that. So he educated everybody. And then they broke up into teams, and each team worked on a problem. Okay, you guys work on the paper money. You guys work on this. You guys work on that. And they all got together then when they were done, and they presented their findings and their remedies. And then they put it all in a book, and it all was documented. And I don't remember the year that it went out. When it came out on Christmas Eve, he had it live televised. These guys worked till, like, I don't know, like 2 a.m. It was pretty exciting.
I'm just surprised Tom Brokaw or Peter Jennings or Dan Rather wasn't talking about this.
I'm not surprised. They were touched with a 10-foot pole.
That's a joke, you know. So.
Yeah. If them guys would have got in on it, you know, it's like the world's best kept secret. You know, I know about it and John knows about it, but anybody who wasn't involved in it doesn't know about it. And back when he did that, you know, YouTube and social media, the computer wasn't like it is today. See, if he did that today and we put it on social media and YouTube, he might have had a lot better results. Because they basically did a blackout on him, you know.
Right. That's why nobody ever heard about it. So.
That's right. So, you know, and he's printed books and all that. Now, the thing they're going after him today with is he made this blue folder that told people how to make their employer stop taking federal withholdings from their paychecks because it was unconstitutional, and the steps that you got to take. And boy, are they're on him. That's what they're going after him today for, that blue book, trying to say that that's an unconstitutional or illegal tax loophole or something, when it's nothing.
Promoting illegality, something like that.
Yeah, some baloney. You know, they got all kinds of stuff. But that's what they're thinking.
The man who died recently in prison that wrote the book about it, you know, it's getting in the same area. So,
yeah, Irwin Schiff.
I can't remember the name, but I probably heard that through the Alex Jones show, where his son was interviewed about that. So,
yeah, Irwin Schiff.
The book. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. He was pretty good, but you know, he kind of got caught up in their statutory world, and they really run roughshod, you know. He taught us a lot of things. Irwin did.
Multi-trillion-dollar government, you know, they have been operating off that 103. I tell everybody everything is the 103 years of the private Federal Reserve. Just imagine, you know, if you or I could print money for that long, and imagine. And that's where it's really at behind the scenes. So I personally think that's the bottom line. So love to see President Trump. You know, I did hear some hint or tinkling of sounds about something does have to be done about the Federal Reserve someday. And then you guys talked earlier about the deep state and just how big it is. So.
Yeah, and Greenspan saying, we don't listen to anybody. Nobody can tell us what to do. And as long as the government's not trying to tell us what to do, we don't care. We don't care about our relationship. I mean, that was the day we should have went after his little butt. You know what I mean?
Yeah, Greenspan? Right.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and, you know, I was just a teenager when Robert Kennedy got taken out. He was really president-elect. He'd won the California primary, And you know, I think that's the last time we really had anybody up till Trump, possibly, hopefully, who had any inclination to do the right thing.
Well, it's a miracle that we have what we have. And whether you like Donald Trump or you don't, you got to go by what he's doing, and you got to pray for him because, look, I don't know what his strategy completely is, and I don't tend to try to second-guess him, but he's got a hell of a job ahead of him, and everybody said, oh, one man can't do. Look, for what one man can do, he's done an awful lot for one man. And I mean, even in his first 100 days, you know? I mean, just undoing all the crap that Obama did, that was work in itself, undoing those presidential edicts. So, you know, and like I said, you know, the deep state is so big, it's, you know, oh, we'll cut their funding. Well, they got their own funding. They don't care. And everything they're doing is unconstitutional and illegal. But, you know, like the Wicked Witch said in Dorothy and the Wizard of Oz, you know, these things have to be done carefully. You just can't go in there with a big stick because you know what? You'll lose. They probably got a military that with scalar weapons that rivals our military. You know, Donald Trump might have an aircraft carrier, but these idiots got some kind of satellite up there with a scalar weapon that could probably blow aircraft carriers out of the sea with one shot. You know what I mean?
Yeah, so all they have to do is have little chips in all electronics to turn off what they need to turn off and turn on what they need to turn on. So,
well, thank Bill Gates for that.
Hey, Gerard. Yeah.
Yes.
Quick question. I had a question come in. Someone wants to, and this is important too because it's donation. Someone wants to know if there's an easy way to increase the monthly donation, which are automatic on the website. And if so, can you tell them how to do it? And can it be done for a specific day for the automatic withdrawal? Do you know how that works?
I don't particularly, but Carl would be able to do that. We should get a hold of Carl. You know, I mean, so in other words, his card's already locked into a certain price, and he doesn't know how to increase it.
And they want to increase it, yeah.
Yeah, I don't know how you would do that because it sounds like he's got to negate the other one. You know, I mean, I know you can start and stop them. In other words, you can stop your monthly donation. There's a spot there to click it. And I would tell him. I mean, I could be wrong, but I would think that it's probably just as easy to go in and stop it, and then redo it again at the new amount.
Yeah, I think it starts up the day that you sign up to do it as well, so you might be able to control the day that it's taken out then that way.
Right. But I think Carl would know those answers if we could get a hold of Carl. Yep. Carl's information, so he can call Carl. I'm sure he could straighten him out.
Yeah, I'll check with Carl.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Okay, and that brings us to after 12 o'clock. After the bewitching hour. So, thank you, everybody, and appreciate all your calls, and keep the faith, and keep your powder dry. And we'll see you next week, same time. And don't forget all the other meetings we have during the week, like Robert said. Come on out, because they're all good, and they're all educational, and look at, you can always pick something up. We all, you know, steel sharpens steel. So you get together and you talk about these things and you'd be surprised what you can figure out. That's the whole idea about the committees of safety. And that's what this is about. Okay. Have a good night, everybody.